Good morning. We'll call the meeting to order of the Agriculture Policy Committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives. And we do have a quorum. Representative Salk moves the amendments of the meeting of February 22nd. All in favor of those amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes aye. Of the 22nd. Favor say aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Thank you. We have a busy agenda today. And first up is a report on the Farmer Lender Mediation Task Force that met this past summer. And I believe we have Commissioner Fredrickson here. And he will lead us through that report. Then we'll get to the bills that pertain to that and the other bills today. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to get myself out of the EQB mode and get into an ag mode here. So just a minute.
Okay,
I'm ready to go.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as the Commissioner of Agriculture. And thank you for the opportunity to be here today to visit with you a little bit about the Farmer Lender Mediation Task Force report. The members and the chairman asked us last year to assemble a group of impacted people to come together and to review the Farmer Lender Mediation Act, which takes us back to about 1986, if I recall. We had input from the Minnesota Farm Bureau, the Minnesota Farmers Union, Minnesota Bankers Association, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, Farm Credit Services, Minnesota State Federation, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, the Minnesota South Dakota Equipment Dealers Association, and the University of Minnesota Extension. Members of our task force included myself. I serve as the chair of the group. Dave Hesse, a farm advocate. Jim Molinar, farm business management instructor. Paku Hang, a farmer. Jessica Hofschult, a farmer. Tim Beldy, a farmer. Kevin Papp, president of Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. Doug Peterson, president of Minnesota Farmers Union. Mark Mitke, Minnesota Bankers Association. Scott Wakefield, Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Jessica Fry from Farm Credit System. Mike Wilagi from Minnesota Credit Union. And Mike St. Ange from Minnesota South Dakota Dealers Equipment Association. He himself is a dealer in the Fargo area. And Kent Olson from the University of Minnesota. The members of the task force agreed that the Farmer Lender Mediation Program is a valuable tool and program for Minnesota farmers and for the state's economy. Discussion of the task force highlighted the option for mandatory mediation to keep farmers operating in times of economic downturn, to keep young and beginning farmers in business, and to assist in mitigating mental health issues, mental health risks due to financial stress. The task force developed consensus around the recommendation and that would address concerns about the program process and ensure proper and fair use of the program. Some folks may be critical of a consensus approach, but I list the people that were around the table, and one would take a look at the various interests that are represented, as I mentioned, and find it would be difficult to get consensus on this important issue. But as a matter of fact, we were able to do that. And so high praise to the committee, and thank you, Chairman Anderson, for your faith in the process and the faith in the Department of Agriculture that could actually carry this off. We do and did come away with some recommendations. The first one, the task force recommends that if the minimum debt level for mediation, which is currently $5,000 in statute, is increased, it should be adjusted for inflation to no more than $13,800, which would be, in fact, 2017 dollars adjusted for inflation. This amount should be adjusted for inflation by multiplying the amount by the cumulative inflation rate as determined by the USDA Index of Cost of Production. Now, after I gave all of this wonderful praise to our consensus approach, we thought we were there, and then we sort of drifted apart and sort of came down on the middle, in the middle of the barbed wire fence on this. And I quote from former Commissioner of Agriculture, Jim Hightower, who said, when you all get 1 foot on one side of the fence and 1 foot on the other, pretty soon you have barbed wire in your butt. And I'm a little worried about that on this one, but it's up to you to make the right decision. We felt that that was fair. Some folks felt that we shouldn't change that number at all. Why would we want to cut somebody out of the process for $5,000 or $8,800 or $10,000? And then there was the discussion that we're in 2017, we're not in 1986. So I get that, I understand it. We had a robust discussion on whether to raise the debt limit and whether it was a good option for the program. Some task force members wanted to ensure the program be available to farms with any size of debt. I understand that, and I mentioned that. So the best we could do is, if you make that change as a committee, that you certainly take into consideration. There were some opinions that didn't necessarily make up a strong a recommendation. However, we're saying if you decide to change it, this is where you should go with it. We also recommended the amount released for family living to an entity going through mediation be raised to meet current costs of living standard. In subsequent years, this amount should be adjusted for inflation. We also came up with the recommendation that if a borrower signs up for mediation, the mediator or mediator's designee should be authorized to perform a credit search and financial statement verification as necessary in order to facilitate completion of a financial statement prior, emphasis on prior, to the first mediation meeting. The fourth recommendation, the task force recommends that in order to best use the state's resources, consideration should be given for a maximum debt level. In other words, ag operations have increased in their ability to use sophisticated financial instruments to benefit operations. A maximum debt level for participation in programs should be considered, perhaps including as a factor the resources of the debtor, such as the sophistication of debt use and the ability to retain an attorney. The task force also recommended that in a timely manner be added to the Minnesota statute 583.27. The subdivision outlines the obligation of good faith required for participation in the program. The task force noted that this obligation was critical to the success of mediations and felt that requiring timeliness in providing information will aid in the success of the mediation. Mr. Chairman, those were the recommendations that the task force agreed upon, one a little bit loosely, but the rest pretty solid. And I would certainly recommend that they be considered as you move forward with your bill draft today, and maybe at some point talk about how the bill actually does align with some of the points that were made in the task force. With that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from members? If not, a great job of explaining
I'm going to save course. Those questions for 5 o'clock tonight, I'll bet. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. So with that, we'll move into the bills today, and first up is the farmer lender mediation bill, and we'll have to do some chair switching here.
The first bill on the agenda is House File 1511. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move House File 1511. Be referred to the next committee, but today I'd like to move the bill for this morning.
Yeah. And we would refer it to the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practice. Chair Anderson, please present your bill.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is the, I guess, the culmination of a lot of work by us here, and also the good work done by the commission that we established last year to look at this program. And a little bit of background to this program, the Farmer Lender Mediation program has been around since 1986, and it's been, we tried to see how many times it had been extended. We're thinking 10 or 12 times in these past 30 years. The program has done a good job with its intent. And my intention, I guess, is to bring it up to the 21st century in terms of some of the numbers. We made a couple of changes in the bill. Of course, the big one, the controversial one, is raising that threshold to qualify for mediation from $5,000. And in the bill, we put that at $15,000. The commission said if you do raise it, go to $13,800. I thought for the sake of round numbers, go to $15,000. And then that would not be adjusted again for at least 5 years when that would be looked at and again adjusted by the Consumer Price Index. And the other change we made dealt with the amount of family living that would be allowed for a family who was in the process of mediation. In the currently in the statute, it talks about $1,600 for the family in mediation, or one and a half times the amount for MFIP, Minnesota Family Protection Program. And the new language, again recommended by the commission, would raise that number to $3,800 a month for family living. But a little bit of a discretion here, I think it's still tied to that one and a half times of MFIP, and we could correct that with Mr. Sullivan. Could you clarify that for us, please?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that is correct. On page 9, at the top of the page, members will see how the language would be laid out as proposed in the bill. The amount released for monthly living expenses would be the lesser of $3,800, or, as under current law, 150% of the amount the family is entitled to under MFIP.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sullivan. And I was talking with the folks from the Department of Ag before the meeting, and if, in fact, it is the wishes of the commission to have that be $3,800, we can come up with an amendment as this bill moves forward and to clarify that amount or the one and a half times the MFIP payment. So that could be changed, but as of right now, it calls for the lesser of those two. And again, I would ask Mr. Sullivan if he could go through the bill. There's a number of sections. If he could give us a quick explanation of the sections in that bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Sullivan, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and members, starting on page 1 of House File 1511, there are a series of changes here in sections 1, on page 2, section 2, and section 3. On page 4, section 4, what all of these sections do is align throughout statute currently where the threshold is set at $5,000. Would point all these sections to one centralized location, which is on page 5, section 6. So now each of these statutes would point to section 6 on page 5, which would set the minimum debt amount, as the chairman said, at $15,000. The change on page 4, section 5, continues on to page 5. This provides that if a creditor extends to the farmer during mediation a new, new loan, line of credit, or other debt, that new debt is not subject to Farmer Lender Mediation Act requirements for a period of 2 years. So if that's a new or a restructured loan to help the farmer out with his or her cash flow or financial situation, that new debt issued by the lender as a result of the mediation would not be subject to mandatory mediation should the farmer have difficulty repaying that new debt. Then on page 5, section 7, this is the commissioner mentioned the task force recommendation to allow excuse me, extension to pull the debtor's credit report. That's on line 5.14 and line 5.15. Lines 5.19 through 5.21 say the mediation request form that the farmer would file with extension must notify the farmer that their omission of a significant unsecured creditor could result in a bad faith determination. And under current law, and the bill would not change this, if the mediator decides that either party is mediating in bad faith, the mediator could essentially rule against that party and end the mediation process. So on page 6, it's section 8, this language also has to do with the farmer being prepared with all relevant financial information prior to the initial mediation meeting. Section 9 requires the mediator to inform the farmer of the requirements of the mediation process, including but not limited to the requirement to participate in good faith and to address any inadequacies identified by the financial analyst that's assigned to help the farmer prior to that initial mediation meeting with the creditor or creditors. Bottom of page 6 is section 10. This section of current law directs the director of extension to provide mediation notices to the different parties. So now under this section 10, extension would also notify any additional secured creditors that the farmer did not report, but that extension uncovered as a result of reviewing the farmer's credit report. So that takes us through page 8. Section 11, this has to do with the information that's included in the termination or mediation termination letter that extension issues at the conclusion of the mediation process. It just specifies that notice must include the date on which the mediation ended, and it must list any new credit that a creditor issued to the farmer as a result of mediation, and that's for purposes of the new exemption. It provides that any new credit issued as a result of the mediation process is not subject to mandatory mediation. So this would be the documentation that could be used to facilitate that. The bottom of page 8, section 12, it's again a language that requires the director of extension to notify all parties of their obligation to participate in good faith, and that not participating in good faith includes failure to provide full financial information by the time that initial mediation meeting takes place. And page 9 continues that section. This is the language that Chair Anderson pointed out earlier. You'll see the next section is a repealer. What that repealer does is it repeals the language that says that the farmer's living expenses as released by the creditor are limited or set at 1.5 times the amount the farmer's family would receive under MFIP, or unless limited by, you see on line 9.5 under current law, $1,600, so it would be the lesser of the two. The language now in section 12, as you see on page 9, puts all that language together. Yeah, the new amount, thank you for that correction, on 9.7 is $3,800. And then there's the direction for extension to update that $3,800 figure every 5 years using the U.S. CPI. And on the bottom of page 9 is the final section, section 14. This provides that the changes that are proposed in this bill apply only to new debt that's initiated on or after August 1st, 2017.
Thank you. Chair Anderson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, a very good summary by Mr. Sullivan. In the two biggest changes were the increasing the family living amount, and then the other one increases the threshold. And the commission recommended that those be adjusted, I believe, annually by the Consumer Price Index. And my thought was, we haven't done this in 30 years. Do we have to do this now every year going forward to raise one of them by $13.12? So that's the reason for putting in the adjustment every 5 years to make it not quite as cumbersome. And I guess I like round numbers, too, as far as that goes. But those are the two financial changes to the bill. And otherwise, we tried to incorporate the things that the commission recommended. and the bill has been drawn up, and I think it does a pretty good job of that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pearson, a question?
Well, I guess I am a little, I do have a question on the $3,800 or the MFIP amount, because the MFIP amount is it like $538, so 1.5 times that would be around $800 a month? Is that?
Mr. Sullivan, do you have an answer?
Mr. Chair and members, I do have the Department of Human Services bulletin with the latest MFIP amounts for 2017. And in my bill summary, I listed, it looks like this. So it depends on the family size, the household size, and how much other income the family brings in. But for a family of four, the max MFIP payment per month would be $1,207. So 1,207 times 150% is $1,800. So my understanding is that the amount of living expenses released for a family of four would be capped at the $1,800. Wouldn't reach anywhere close to the $3,800.
Representative Pearson?
Well, so again, to that point, you know, if we're doing the lesser of those two amounts, no one's going to obtain $3,800 or anywhere near $3,800. So in statute, it's almost irrelevant that that's there because the MFIP amounts currently capped at the $1,800. So if we're trying to make it look like we're allowing them to release up to $3,800, we never are. So it's just a little concerning to me that the statute's a little misleading because no one is going to obtain $3,800 a month as a payment in this scenario. Unless I'm misunderstanding something, I just want clarity on that.
Chair Anderson, go ahead.
I think you'd have to have 12 children to qualify for the $3,800. And again, talk with the folks at the Department of Ag, and then go back and check on the wishes of the commission. And if it was their intention to raise it to $3,800, we'll do an amendment and take off the 1.5 times MFIP. And I suspect that that's what their intention was, but again, we want to get clarification of that before we offer the amendment.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions from members with Chair Anderson? Representative Saw?
In regard to that, I do find it a little disingenuous to put that number out there when the calculation is going to be based on a thing that hasn't been increased in quite a number of years. In my inexperience, it's one of the things that has been told to me is that MFIP has been sort of buried in cement for a long time. And to use it as an indicator that there may be some growth is completely false and misleading to the people that could find themselves in this place. So I'll just put that as an editorial part of it. But the question did clarify. The other part that I have a real question about is, why did we decide, or why is it proposed on the $15,000 minimum debt limit that is only recalculated every 5 years? And maybe you just also, in between me asking it and that you sort of indicated that it's because you don't, it seems unnecessary to recalculate every year.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative South. Yeah, that's basically it. We haven't changed this entire statute for 30 years, so now if we make a change, we have to adjust these every year to the CPI. There may be a small adjustment at 1 year. So do you raise it, again, $13.10? I think that's cumbersome. So we'll put in the 5 years, so it wouldn't be an every-year thing, and if they are to be raised or possibly lowered, we could do it in some semblance of a round number.
Thank you. I just, like I said, that information sort of probably crossed in my brain, and I wanted to go clarify that that's what you were talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions for Chair Anderson? If not, we're going to go to the first testifier, David Skillbred from the Independent Community Bankers. And when you come up, please, for the record, state your name, and we ask you to keep your testifying down to 3 to 5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Stilbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. We have members throughout the state, urban, suburban, and rural. Most of them are in the rural areas, and ag lending is a very important niche of business for our members. But we had, as Representative Anderson said, and as the commissioner said, an appointee to this task force. We thought that it was a very good idea to have this. We commend Representative Anderson and this committee and the legislature for creating it. It needed to be done. And also the commissioner for the good work that he did to bring all these people at the table together. As he said, it was we did develop a consensus, and it was a very diverse group, and therefore having to do so, I think, is really a very great thing. With respect to House File 1511, there might be a couple of loose ends that you folks have discussed right now, but in total, we support the bill strongly. We hope that it goes forward, and we'll continue and be happy to work with all of you on any of those details that might be understood, misunderstood, or not tied down tight enough for you. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Good, good. Thank you. Members, we're going to go through all the testifiers, and then if there's questions, we'll do it at that time. Next testifier is Tom Peterson, Minnesota Farm Union. Again, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I also I helped serve on the task force. I replaced Doug Peterson after he retired working on the task force. We support most of the changes in the bill and worked on them. Our main concern, I'll just cut right to it, is the $5,000 or raising it to $15,000. The way Farmers Union works, we take grassroots input from our members, and I'm a member of Farmers Union, and so I put the $13,000 into my own county convention so that we would have a discussion at it at our county convention, and then asked my county to pass it, even though they kind of opposed it. And we took it to our state convention where to have that discussion, because it's been in our policy for a long time to support the $5,000 threshold, and it was soundly defeated at our convention, and to go back to $5,000. And I think that, you know, I understand that farming's changed, but it's also changed for, it really depends on your farm. You can be in different areas, and on a $5,000 to $15,000 bill could be something that is very key to your farm. Could be smaller type farmers, could be part-time farmers who are very important in a lot of your different areas that rely on another job or have a healthcare situation. These are the types of things, because I've always been interested in this. I say, what kind of debt, goes to mediation that's that hard on your farm? And a lot of times that's what it is. It's a part-time person who loses a job, they have a healthcare situation, and this is what happens, and the mediation does help. I also look at, I don't have the statistics with me, I apologize for that. I think maybe they're in the report, or you can get them from the University of Minnesota. The mediation is successful most of the time, that it has a successful outcome. And I think that's what we really want. We want to keep farmers farming, and we want to have, a lot of discussion about beginning farmers and how we're doing to help those people. Well, here's a bill, and it's something that we have that helps keep farmers farming. And so by lowering it, you know, we're going to take what is currently, maybe you want to say, a right that somebody has away, and we're going to make it more difficult for that person. And so based on that, we have concerns about that. With that all being said, most of the farmers that I do talk to are way above $15,000. You know, that's the majority of the farms that several that I've talked to in the last month. As many of you know, the economy right now is very tough. One I talked to yesterday is in the $75,000 range. Others are in the hundreds of $1,000s range. And so the $15,000 is a better discussion than what we've had in the past. We've talked about raising it to 75 or 100,000. And so I do want to compliment the Chair Anderson for, you know, doing what he could, but I have to explain our position on that. I also, there were good things on there too. The good faith, the living standards. You know, I basically felt like on those higher end farms that are full time that are using mediation, that it would be helpful to raise the living standards. It sounds like we still have a little bit of work to clarify how that's going to work, but that would be helpful. The other main thing I would say is really important in here is Section 5, Subdivision 4, Part 6 of the bill, which talks about what we hear from banks a lot of time is they don't want to do keep doing notices, and the idea is to get mediation right the first time. Most of the mediations I've ever had, they don't go into mediation time after time after time. And so this kind of gets at that. If people are using mediation to kind of, I don't want to say game the system, but this is a part two that I thought was something we kind of helped to, you know, agree to. So it's another piece to maybe look at. So last thing we'd like to see as part of this bill, I talked to the chairman about it, as an extension. The bill sunsets next year, and not to mean that you're not going to meet again next year and couldn't do it next year, but if we're doing like a whole package, it might make sense to do a 3 or 4 year extension. Has been, we've done extensions anywhere from 2 to 4 years, and you know, so I encourage the committee to think about that somewhere in the process. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next testifier is Don Pelkin. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. From, state your name and where you're from, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. that's good. It's a good pronunciation. I'm still learning it.
Oh, good. Me too.
Even though I'm a Finlander. My name is, as you correctly stated, Don Pilkinen. And I'm executive director of Minnesota COAC. It's a nonprofit citizens organization which began as a neighborhood organization in the Duluth West End in 1975, and expanded to central Minnesota in the 1980s to work with farm families on their issues of concern. And before I go any further, I just want to try to give the Main Street business perspective of the program. We worked in the past on issues such as the Farmers Home Administration, borrowers' rights, sustainable commodity prices, RBGH milk labeling, the Minnesota Dairy Producers Board, and feedlot permitting issues. Over the years, we've worked with Minnesota Farmers Union and Land Stewardship Project and Morrison County Farmers Union, co-sponsors our annual farm picnic and peers. During the farm crisis of the mid-80s, we worked for the moratorium on farm foreclosures and the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Because of the volatility of farm revenue and expenses, as Tom mentioned, we believe the mediation program is always needed, and we support the debt threshold at the original level of $5,000. Every summer for the last 36 years, we visited central Minnesota businesses about our annual farm picnic with the same theme year in and year out, farmers and business on Main Street. So to see how Main Street businesses regard the program, we surveyed the 97 in this current issue of our COAC Farm Shopper's Guide. We found that 81% of the responders support the program, and 68% support keeping the debt threshold at the original $5,000 for farmers to qualify for the program. The remainder said to raise the debt level to $10,000, and one said to raise it up to $10,000 or above $10,000. We agree with the majority of business owners to keep the debt level at or near 5,000 because it's just good business sense to be able to deal with debt before it gets too big. And so they're, again, giving us their business sense on that debt level. Three of the four creditors we visited accept today's reality that newer farmers are dependent on off-farm employment for cash flow. They said these farmers are deserving of the mediation program and that it's important that they are prepared for mediation in order to show good faith. One ag lender said mediation successfully reached reconciliation in 8 of 10 cases in his recent experience. The reason for Main Street support of the program is that the business owners are from family farms, farm part-time, and or have family members farming. So in conclusion, I thank you for letting me share with you their opinions on this issue.
Thank you. Is there any other testifiers for or against in the audience? Seeing none, then members, do any of the members have any questions for the testifiers? Representative Miller, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually for Chair Anderson. So,
okay.
Perhaps my naivete is still coming out because when we talk about this 5,000 moving up to 15, so let me just walk through it very quickly. There'll be a question somehow packed in here. When this first came into law, it was set at $5,000, and I assume the intention of that was, if you will, any sort of debts below 5,000 back in, was this, what year was this again?
1986.
Yeah, 1986. I assume that back then it was just, maybe this is perhaps where I'm missing the point. The 5,000 was sent because anything under 5,000 would have just been too burdensome for the system. Well, you said it, they said it, they set a floor. And so if it's been 5,000 since 1986, when I look at debt loads for farms at 15,000, I think of what could be possibly less than 15,000. I look at like a vehicle, or I look at, and I don't want to make light of any debts or where people have trouble, but I just want to say it just seems like it opens the door. When we first started discussing this a couple of years ago, I actually thought in minds of more than 50,000 is where the mediation should be. So the 15,000 seems more reasonable. So I guess my question to you, Chair, is, and this may be a bit redundant, but I need this to understand, the changing from 5 to, like, what would be a practical debt that would be reflected with, like, a $15,000 debt versus a $5,000 debt to where this could cause problem for people in between? Is that a fair enough question? Was I clear enough? I guess I'm just not mentally understanding, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not understanding where this puts people in a disparate situation in between that 5 and 15, other than that it would perhaps kind of alleviate the burden of just having lots of... If 5,000 was good in 1986, I would just think the 15,000 is very reasonable today. So maybe you can explain to me why that's reasonable.
I'm Chair Anderson. Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative Miller. Just because of inflation, I did some number crunching last night, and back in 1986, for example, seed corn was about $30 a bag. So with that $5,000, you could buy 166 bags of seed corn. Today, you can get seed corn, the top-end stuff, about $300 a bag. So with that $5,000, you could buy 16 bags of seed corn. So just... My thought in raising the ceiling is to recognize that costs have gone up substantially. In 1986, you could buy 10 acres of average farmland for $500, or for $5,000, I mean to say. And today, you could maybe buy 1 acre of land for $5,000. And I would also add that, and I understand we have a lot of smaller farmers as well, but also in current legislation, if you farm less than 60 acres, you have to have at least $20,000 in ag sales to even qualify for mediation. So maybe some of the smaller farmers don't reach that threshold either, which has been in current law since 1986.
Thank you. Representative Salk?
kind of in this same area, and a lot of this, I do apologize for being a new view of this sort of stuff. These questions might be a little strange, but generally with debt, you're dealing with the two elements. One is the risk that the lender takes on, and then the need to satisfy that debt for the farmer. And this place by which the system is expecting that mediation kicks in is this floating number, and we're having trouble figuring out how does it be relevant when you're considering small farms versus large farms. And Representative Miller's question about, yeah, if you consider larger operations, I mean, we're way past the cost of even one vehicle or one implement. And then your point on the thing. But what I was wondering is, was there ever discussed the idea of a sliding number that would slide with some enumeration? Because I know in my day when we were discussing with risk and loans and debt ratios and all that sort of thing, it wasn't that every single house had the same number. Every single house had a very similar risk ratio. And so I was wondering if that could be a part of a solution, and whether it was ever discussed or not, the idea that a very small operation would have a relatively small number, but probably just as risky for the lender, because they're looking down the throat of writing it off versus being able to have it satisfied. And then, of course, it could scale with the size of the operation, and there's lots of different ways that somebody could be smart enough to figure out what that sliding scale would be as a percent of revenue, percent of gross revenue, percent of ag sales, all of these kinds of things. So there's, in that is my question, but primarily, has something like that ever been discussed or contemplated?
Chair Anderson? To my knowledge, Representative, it has not. At least I don't know if it has. But, you know, the bigger operations would automatically qualify it, that whatever you set the threshold at, if you're above that threshold, you'd automatically qualify. So the question, again, goes back to how low do you set that threshold for the smaller farmers to qualify? And that's what we're discussing today.
Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Anderson, could you tell me what the difference is between the United States Department of Ag's Index of the Cost of Production and the United States All Items Consumer Price Index?
Chair Anderson, go ahead.
I'm not trying to be funny. I'm just curious, is there a difference in that? What the difference is?
I don't know if anybody from the department, I don't think they do either. We can try to get that, but I don't know offhand what the difference is.
Again, I'm not trying to, but it's in Subdivision 5, you're using that as the determination for the index. Is the index the Department of Ag's Index of the Cost of Production? But when you're talking about the other, regarding the lesser of the two clauses, you're talking about the United States All Items Consumer Price Index. And when you were describing it, you talked about the minimum eligible debt of $15,000 as being using the CPI, which I'm thinking the CPI is what's being used in the other one, but not in the $15,000 threshold. So I'm just, I guess I don't know the difference. I don't know if there is a major difference, but I'm just thinking, for one thing, if you're trying to add consistency, that would be an area to add consistency. And then the other thing is, I don't support raising it. I want to make that clear. I really do support the $5,000 limit. But if you're in the process of changing it, the other thing on Subdivision 5 and page 5, I think that's it just reads to me a bit confusing, and I think we have really good staff that write our bills for us, and so I'm not trying to say anything about that, but the minimum debt amount is $15,000 as adjusted by the Director for Inflation in 2022 and every 5 years thereafter. So I read that as perhaps the minimum debt amount is $15,000 in 2022, with every 5 years after. So I just think that maybe there needs to be some clarity there. Again, I don't support doing that, don't support increasing it to 15,000, but if you're going to do that, there may be some clarification needed there, and then just regarding the two things. So again, I'm not trying to you know, just quiz you on something that's kind of random there, but that was just my comments. Mr. Chair.
Chair, is there any comments to that? Or, I see we have the Department of Agriculture. Did you want to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As it relates to the two indices, obviously the USDA index of cost of production deals with cost of production, and as we know, if you go back to probably 1986, corn was somewhere in the area of a dollar, and I'm guessing 40, 45. I was farming then, I should know that, but I don't recall. And that fluctuates, obviously. And so we utilize then the USDA index of the cost of production. If you shift then to the next one, the all-item consumer price index that you raised, when we're talking about cost of living is the same kind of for everyone, so we use a separate index to determine that.
Thank you. Another follow-up there, Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Commissioner. I knew that you would have the answer. I appreciate that you came forward with that. And perhaps then the index of the cost of production actually could, hopefully it goes in the right direction, but if it goes in the wrong direction, that could also change this anyway. But thank you.
Okay. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, a couple of questions. I don't fully understand. I've only been looking at the mediation and the services that this new bill adjusts over the weekend. So maybe I've got two questions here. Is the mediation, is it backed up? I mean, are they up to date? Do they take a long time to get into the system and then get through the system? Or is it a 30-day process, a 90-day process?
Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. I'm being stumped here again. I'm not sure. When somebody applies for mediation, there are time periods when they have to get
like
their
lifetime coming
together. And not sure how long it takes. We heard testimony the other day that they're having to add more staff because of the backlog, because of the economic situation right now, that the mediation is being used more.
I'll state your name for the record and address that question. We appreciate that.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brent Hales. I'm the Senior Associate Dean, Chief Financial Officer at University of Minnesota Extension and former Director of the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Our mediations are running very smoothly. There's not a backlog per se, and the challenge that we're having is actually just volume, as the chair stated. And the number of mediations in the last 4 years or last 3 years has significantly increased, and we should hit another record number of mediations this year.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mahoney?
To the testifier, so are your mediations taking 30 days, 60 days, 120 days?
It depends on how ready the farmers are, as well as the creditors. Sometimes it gets extended, but typically they're handled within the 30 to 60 day window because of the time of notification to the time of resolution.
Okay, Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who gets to take this one, but it sounds like the U of M is the only place that you go for mediation. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Hales, go ahead.
Yes, sir. That is correct. The extension is the Farmer Lender Mediation Program is the mediator as identified by statute.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions? If not, what we have right now is Representative Bly has a A1 amendment. Representative Bly, would you like to move your amendment at this time?
Yes, I would, Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Discussion to amendment. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. The A1 amendment has to do with I think right now the expiration date would be 2018, and the amendment would move it to 2022. So it would give some more certainty. It would make sure that people can feel that this has been at least settled for those years. It is one of the recommendations that Tom Peterson mentioned when he was giving his testimony, and I think that this is something that I brought for discussion at any rate.
Chair Anderson, thoughts on that?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bly. Yeah, I think that's a good idea, and we certainly can extend it. It wouldn't have to be done this year, but we certainly can make it kind of a package program, so I would accept that amendment, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Other discussions for members? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Bly renews his motion on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and an amendment is adopted. Representative Bly has an A2 amendment. Representative Bly, would you like to move your amendment at this time?
Yes, I would, Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Discussion to this amendment. Go ahead, Representative.
First, let me say I really appreciate the work that Chair Anderson has done on the bill, and also the work of the task force. I think having worked with them before, they're very reasonable, and it's been good to work with you on this issue, and I think appreciate your bringing it forward and having the full discussion of the various proposals. So what this one has to do with is to keep the level at 5,000 as opposed to moving it to 15,000. I think, as we've heard in some of the testimony, there are still a number of uncertainties, even though we have seen inflation happen. And I appreciate the comments that were made about health care, for instance, which we see really does affect farmers in an adverse way. I think also that we oftentimes think about a debt problem being in isolation rather than being dynamic, and I think it can change over time. And there is argument for trying to address it at the beginning. I mean, maybe it's 5,000 and then it quickly goes to 15,000 or something as time proceeds. So I think having the ability to address the issue of the debt early for a farmer when they see things going down. And a lot of times farmers are looking into the future to see what's going to happen. As if things don't look very good, they may need to address an issue early on. I think the lower level allows folks to do that and to be thinking about that. Looking at, as we talked about this issue in the past, I think there were about 29% of the mediation events that occurred at that level under 15,000, spread between 5 and 15,000. So I think that's a big enough number that I think I wouldn't want to exclude those folks from being able to access at that level. So that's my reason for bringing it forward.
Chair Anderson, go ahead.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. At this time, I'm going to oppose that amendment. And again, just a couple of numbers to throw out at you. Iowa has a very similar program as our farmer lender mediation. Again, their program began back in the 1980s, like ours did. Their threshold since day one has been $20,000. And that's what their threshold is today in Iowa. And I think raising ours to 15,000 is a reasonable attempt to bring it into line with modern day agriculture. And one other number I'll throw out, again, I was too busy last night doing numbers, but going from 5 to 15,000, that's an increase of 2.76 going from 5 to 15,000. But if you go the other way, going down from 5,000, what would that number have been in 1986 if you would do inflation the other way? The number is $1,811.60. If that would have been set at that level in 1986, today we'd be at the $5,000 level because of inflation. And in 1986, interest rates were 18%, 19%, 20%. We had a ag crisis on our hands. And the level was set at that time at $5,000. I think we have maybe somebody here that was around at that time that helped set that level at 5,000 back then. And again, I just think today, 2017, at 15,000 is reasonable. So I'm going to oppose the amendment now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Other discussions or questions? Okay. Let's see. That would be Mr. Skilbred. Did you want to share something? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, David Skilbred with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. We would oppose this amendment also. And if you look at if you argue that the trigger should stay at 5,000, then it seems to me that the cost of living should stay where it is also. If you're going to raise one because of interest and cost of living changes, the prices of things going up, then I think you have to change the other one. So to change one and not the other seems to be illogical to me. Secondly, the argument that a lower number helps get into the business of helping a farmer who might be in trouble earlier than a higher number. Underwriting for farming and every other sort of loan activity has changed dramatically on the bank side since 1986. Just as farming has changed drastically since that time, so too lenders changed their underwriting drastically. They are much more in touch with their people that they are loaning money to. They are much more out front in watching how things are going, going out to those individuals, asking if there's a problem if they see a yellow flag. So I think that the industry does that. It is a common practice, so to speak. And therefore, I don't think that the lower number really adds much. And like I said before, if you're going to admit increases in costs for one area, I think you have to admit it for the other one. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion on the A2 amendment? Go ahead, Representative Bly.
I do want to call for a roll call on the amendment, if that's right.
Okay, roll call has been called. Okay.
And I just think that there's, in my mind, as I talk to some of the farmers in my area, there's still so much uncertainty as we look forward into the future here, and it unsettles me to raise that amount at this time. So, I still support my amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, we have a roll call vote. Go ahead, Mr. Webster.
Anderson.
No.
Backer.
No.
Bennett.
No.
Bly.
Yes.
Daniels. Johnson.
Yes.
Kunesh Bodin?
Yes.
Lewick?
No.
Mahoney?
Yes.
Mariani?
Yes.
Miller?
No.
Nornes? Pearson?
No.
Poppy?
Yes.
Austin?
No.
Salk?
Yes.
Okay. The vote is seven yeas and seven nays, so the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Okay, thank you. So we move on to the bill. Representative, any Any final comments on House File 1511? As amended.
Mr. Chair, no really final comments. Good discussion today, and we did accept the one amendment. And I would ask for your support of House File 1511 to be re-referred.
Yeah, we're going to refer it to the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practice. So, Chair, Representative renews his motion that House File 1511, as amended, be referred to the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Thank you. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 1221. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, putting away all the papers up here and getting sure. ready for the next one, I would like to move House File 1221 to be re-referred to the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practices.
Okay, thank you. Chair Anderson, please present your bill when you're ready.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill attempts to give livestock producers some additional protections against what they call nuisance lawsuits, and there still are protections for the neighbors in this bill. And let's get right to the testimony, Mr.
Chair. Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Anderson. Our first testifier is Jerry or Dave Priceler. Thank you. Please state for your record, state your name and what group you're from. And we do. We are adjourned at 12, so keep your comments brief and to the point. We would appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is David Priceler, and I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. We're located down in Mankato. We, on behalf of the Minnesota Pork Producers, we encourage passage of House File 1221. Although it's a lengthy bill, it's really fairly simple. And I'm going to talk about the two pieces that are within the bill. The first section is on nuisance. And really our message here is really equal protection under the law. If we look at pigs, for example, a pig farm does not have any sort of nuisance protection under current law if that farm is over 1,000 animal units. In the case of cattle, the farm is over 2,500 head. But if it happens to be a chicken farm or a turkey farm, you can have an infinite amount of chickens or turkeys on that site, and they would have nuisance protection. And so our argument here is that really equal protection under the law. The proposal here is to actually strike the animal unit caps. I think it's important, though, to realize that the only way that you actually have that nuisance protection is that you have to make sure that that the farm is, first of all, located in an ag-zoned area. The farm has to comply with all provisions of federal, state, and county laws. So it has to be, for example, in complete compliance with its local conditional use permit, all state and federal rules regulating that site, otherwise it does not receive nuisance protection. And also it has to operate according to generally accepted agricultural practices. I think it's also important to realize that none of our neighboring states have any sort of caps on size of feedlots from the standpoint of nuisance protection. And so all of those neighboring states, including Nebraska, not neighboring but a large livestock state, none of them have caps within their nuisance protection laws. And the other thing is that, you know, over time, things have, they have grown. You know, when this bill was actually originally put together, it would have been in excess of 25 years ago, when there were very few farms that would have been over those sizes. Today, we do have a number of them. You know, and that growth is really driven by trying to figure out a way to really make a living. So whether it's covering the tax bill or the health insurance bill or trying to bring that second generation back to the farm, that's why they're growing in order to do that. So that's the first part of the bill. And then the second part is regarding mediation. And you've heard an awful lot about mediation already within the previous bill. What we would like to do and propose, and again, there's a lot of language here, but to boil it down, What we'd like to propose is that we utilize the existing Farm Credit Mediation Program that has trained people that have done very well over the years in helping, in this case, you know, lenders and farmers mediate things. But they don't just do that. They've also been getting more into cases, for example, involving USDA and farmers over issues around wetlands, over issues around government farm programs and payments and those sorts of things. And so it's not that they've just been only dealing with, you know, banks and farmers. And they're pretty skilled people and have done a nice job with it. So what we would propose is that the within this bill is that to expand the scope to where if there is a farm and their neighbor that has a dispute, that they would go to mediation first before, or at least have the option of going to mediation first before filing a civil lawsuit. Now, I'll grant you that in many cases that you would have, once a civil lawsuit is filed, and you may have hearings in front of the judge might order mediation, but we think it's a whole lot better idea to try and offer that up front before things get even more contentious than they maybe already are, and also before each side is spending an awful lot of money. And so let's just see if we can get people at the table that have got a difference of opinion on something and see if they can't work something out. And so that's really the reason why we're looking at this. There are some other states that have got this sort of a program. There are four others, Iowa, Maryland, New Jersey, and North Carolina, all have some sort of a mediation program that's required before you would see something like this go forward. I appreciate the time constraints that you're under, and so I'll end my comments there and would stand for any questions.
Okay, what we're going to do, members, is get through all the testifiers first and then do the questions. So the next person on deck is, we have James Kane. Is he in the audience? Are we pronouncing your name correctly?
No, you are not.
Okay. Well, correct us on the record, please. And again, we have this room up to 12 noon, so be precise, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is James Connie. It's K-A-N-N-E. I'm a lifelong dairy farmer, have been all my whole life. Not sure when I became a dairy farmer rather than a family farmer who had milk cows. And for the record, I mean, we now have pork producers and poultry producers instead of family farms with pigs on them and turkeys and chickens. A little bit of background, we've seen a huge decline in family farms over the years. Just as a baseline between 92 and 14, we've seen a 76% reduction in just milk production of family farms. But if you go back to the baseline, I pulled up a University of Minnesota study. You go back all the way to 1960 when I was a kid, we had 86,000 dairy farms in Minnesota. Today we have a little over 3,000. We have destroyed our family farm base in this state. As such, we are looking at dairy production, pork production. For that matter, we're looking at protein sources, not pigs or beef or dairy. And because of that, it's become an industrial model rather than a family farm model. And do we really want that? Our roots in this state are in the soil. And if we move away from that, if we move away from who we are and what we are based on, we have lost who we will become. It has been said that what we are to be is what we are now becoming. As a family farmer, I'd say I'm becoming extinct. And what we are doing today is just putting one more nail in the coffin of the family farm. And we're doing it by saying, okay, we're just going to raise the threshold up again. We're going to move the line a little bigger and a little larger. The family farm that we have today, you have not recognized it 40, 50 years ago. And because of that, I would ask you today to vote against this raising of the limits. I would ask you to reconsider who we are and what we are becoming. And I would love to come back here and talk about how we could talk about a revitalization, a renaissance in our rural communities. Because we could do it. But we're not going to do it by continually taking away family farms and making them bigger and bigger and turning them into corporations. The point had been made earlier that poultry is exempt, basically. Basically, that train has left the station is what has been conceded, that they are a corporate entity. They are controlled, vertically controlled entity within this state. Basically, if you work for poultry in this state, whether it's turkey or chickens or whatever, you're a low-wage worker in their factories or on their farms, or you are a contractor with a very low return. Is that what we want for our future in our rural areas of the state? Because it destroys our communities. We do not have, going forward then, the most important thing that we produced in rural Minnesota, which was our kids growing up on family farms. Think about how many people here can harken back to their father, family, grandparents, whatever, who are farmers. They have roots. We're losing that. Let's not put another nail in the coffin. Thank you. Any questions?
We'll do two more testifiers, then we'll do questions there, Mr. Carney. Thank you. We have Stephen Carpenter. Come on down. Again, state your name and who you're with.
Excellent pronunciation, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yours was easier. Thank you.
My name is Stephen Carpenter. I am at Farmers Legal Action Group, which is a nonprofit law firm here in St. Paul that works on behalf of family farmers. And I'm testifying on behalf today of Land Stewardship Project. A couple of specific comments about the proposed bill, and I'll will not repeat what others have said before me. I would point out one thing about nuisance law to begin with. It's a very, very old concept. It goes back to common law in England and Britain. When a lawyer thinks about nuisance law, if we define it just for a second, something is a nuisance if it interferes with the use of your property. And so when a lawyer thinks about nuisance law, what they're thinking about is one of the rights you have as a property owner is not to have the use of that property interfered with. And so a nuisance is when someone interferes with your use of your own property. And so I just, as a legal matter, wanted to clarify that just for a moment. So I have three specific things that I was hoping to say about 1221 today. One is that it perhaps inadvertently, by requiring the mediation for any nuisance dispute, perhaps inadvertently creates a very long delay whereby somebody could suffer from an extreme, essentially unlimited nuisance without a remedy, so that even if it sort of, in theory, worked in the long term, the long term is, in fact, very long, and one could be forced to live with an extremely severe nuisance without any remedy. So, and the way this would happen would be, think about how the whole mediation program would work. You are a neighbor, you're suffering from an odor nuisance, let's say. You would like to file a lawsuit, so you file for mediation. That leads to a consultation, which likely leads to plan to abate the nuisance. And if the abatement doesn't work, it likely leads to a mediation. Either party has the right to suggest another mediation. Each of these steps involve delay, procedure. The statute as it's written requires, it allows someone to extend a deadline for any, you know, for reasonable purposes. Let's assume that every extension of a deadline is reasonable, fair enough. It's still delay. And so after all that, you might still have this nuisance, which the operation was unable or unwilling to control, and only then would you be able to go to court. And, you know, somebody else with more direct experience with how mediation has worked in a debtor creditor world might have some thoughts on this. But when I look at the structure of it and the way that it's set up and the various deadlines and the possibility for extended deadlines and repeated mediation, I think we've got to face the fact that you could go many, many months with an essentially unlimited nuisance and have no legal remedy except to sort of ploddingly go through this process. And, you know, perhaps that's intended, perhaps not, but as I read it, that's what the statute seems to require. A second thought that I have about 1221 involves a somewhat different issue, and I do sense that this may be an inadvertent drafting issue. When I read 1221, what I see is a statute written with the idea that we need to change the way livestock odor is dealt with under nuisance law. However, when you read the statute, the mediation requirement isn't triggered just by livestock odor nuisance. It's triggered by all nuisances originating essentially on a farm. When you look at the definitions involved, it's any nuisance action involving an agricultural operation. Agricultural operation is defined, as you would suspect, very broadly to include essentially all kinds of farms. The trick here is that nuisances aren't always just livestock odor. They involve a lot of other types of things, and maybe today we can just focus on one possible example of that, which would be pesticide drift. We know pesticide drift has happened, you know, it's ongoing. In general, people deal with it in a neighborly way, but we know it occurs. And interestingly, we know that it occurs very often between two farms. In other words, one operation drifts accidentally onto another. So here's a case where farmers are often on both sides of the equation. And here is the problem. In quite an important Minnesota State Supreme Court case, Johnson v. Painesville, the court was faced with the question of what happens when pesticide drift comes over to an organic farm and damages their crops. What should the organic farmer, in this case Johnson, do? And let's leave aside, you know, the facts and, you know, whether, how much it hurt them or whatever. Let's just say, here's a real scenario. You're an organic farmer, pesticide drift comes on your farm, your organic certification is in danger, you can't market your crops the same way that you would. The Minnesota State Supreme Court answered the following question. What is it that Johnson should do? And their answer is, the Johnsons must rely solely on the law of nuisance. They can't do any other sort of action, only nuisance law. So it's required. And so in the state of Minnesota, if you're subjected to pesticide drift, you must use nuisance. 1221, therefore, would be required if you're an organic or other farmer who's drifted upon, if you want to file a lawsuit. And again, that might make sense on the surface of it, but with pesticide drift, you have a very different kind of problem than you do with odor. And that the foremost in the sense that a one-time event can be utterly devastating to your crop. If you read the statute, it's clearly aimed at an ongoing nuisance. We know pesticide drift can be ongoing, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. You could have substantial losses from one event, one morning. So how would the statute work? Let's say you're drifted upon. You're a farmer. You lose a big part of your crop. What do? If you want to file a nuisance lawsuit, which the state Supreme Court says is your only option, you must go to court? No. You go through mediation. And when you go through the whole process of mediation, if your neighboring farmer who drifted upon you decides to go ahead and abate the nuisance, That is to say, let's say in a very good faith effort, they abate the nuisance by making sure that they will never drift on you again, at least in the same way, in the same process. That if they abate that nuisance and they can say to you, this will not happen again, you have no right under this statute to file a nuisance claim. That is to say, your entire crop could be destroyed. And under the state law in Minnesota, if 1221 is passed, as I read it, you would have no remedy. It would be the death of anybody's crops who got drifted upon in Minnesota, period. And I hate to be so dramatic about it, but I think if you read this closely with the definitions involved in the way that abate the nuisance is emphasized and read it along with Johnson v. Painville, I think that you would come to the same conclusion. The last thing that I wanted to point out circles back to the notion that I mentioned at the beginning, which is that nuisance is a property right. It's a right that you have along with owning property. And my suggestion is that if you take away that right, let's say, for example, for someone like in the Johnson scenario, where you have a remedy that protects your property, and the state legislature takes away that property, and doesn't offer you that property right, and doesn't offer you fair market value for it, you may well have a constitutional violation. The Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and a similar provision in the Minnesota State Constitution says that the government may not take your property without just compensation. And the state Supreme Court in Iowa and some other legal commentators have concluded that right to farm laws can, in some cases, trigger that protection. So along that analysis, you can, you know, regulate for safety and economy any way you want to. That's your prerogative. But you as the legislature, when you start taking away someone's property rights, according to this law, need to provide just compensation. And I want to emphasize, it's not for certain that would happen. You know, some states reject this theory. You know, it gets complicated. What's a constitutional violation? What's not? My point would be this. If you're, let's say, drifted upon, and you would otherwise have a very large lawsuit against whoever drifted upon you, and you have lost this property right due to this legislation, and you go to a lawyer, the lawyer would tell you, you have something to talk about, you have some real options here, because this statute may not be constitutional. I wouldn't want to predict how it would turn out, but you'd have a lot to talk about. And so, in my view at least, the law may be unconstitutional. Those are my thoughts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Our next testifier is Joel Carlson. Again, state your name and share us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
You nailed Carlson, too.
Another simple one.
I'm Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Minnesota Association for Justice. And we have some concerns about the bill. I won't reiterate Mr. Carpenter's testimony. He hit many of the concerns that we have, but we really feel at its core, unintended or not, that this bill denies average property owners their constitutional right to redress and their constitutional right to a trial by jury. And when you look at how the bill is structured, which is really unlike any other that I've looked at in my 24 years of doing work for this association, you're really banned from filing a case in court unless you get a letter from the Ag Extension Service that says that you can do it. And that's really unusual. And I worry about that. And then if you did get that letter that you can proceed in court, you really don't have much to have the court to review. And I'm going to go through just a couple of points in the bill as we flip through it, and I'll tell you why that happens on the final page of the bill. We've long had concerns about eliminating the 1,000 animal unit on page one of the bill, eliminating that protection. And I appreciate the comments from the pork producers that some large producers have financial ability to create different controls than small farmers, but you're talking about some very big operations that are moving into existing neighborhoods, and we do have concerns about that for homeowners. On page two of the bill, Mr. Chair, we generally don't have legislative findings in bills anymore, but if we do, they're usually based on something the legislature has done or studied, and I have to say that I don't think the legislature has studied whether or not alternative dispute resolution on nuisance claims is an appropriate or inexpensive form for claimants to be heard. I don't know that that's a finding that we can make right now, and that you could even find as you walk through this. This is not an inexpensive model for the average homeowner to bring a claim forward. As I mentioned, the person with the keys to the courthouse here on page two is the director of the Minnesota Extension Service. That's who is going to control whether or not you have the ability to bring a nuisance claim in court. And what they can look at is nuisance, but they really can't look at what some of these claims are about, which is diminution of your property value, health effects from agricultural nuisances. They really can look at the nuisance, which is the interference with the use of your property, but they really don't allow in this bill the director to look at those other claims that are attendant to nuisance conditions. You'll note on page three that it is the Minnesota Extension Service that now trains the mediators, and that's important as you read further on in the bill. We have an existing system right now in Minnesota run by the Supreme Court. It's under Minnesota Rules 114 of the General Rules of Practice that oversees mediators and arbitrators. It's required in all civil litigation except for medical malpractice and divorce cases involving domestic dispute. So every single case that's going to get filed in court is already going to go through some form of alternative dispute resolution by existing court rules. We're duplicating that with this bill in a troubling way because we're not having people who are trained mediators. They're trained by the Extension Service. If you look at why that's problematic on page 4, you'll see on lines 4.19 to 4.20 that the mediator has to inform the homeowner what the risks of litigation would be involving a civil suit regarding this dispute. That is hardly the role of a mediator. The mediator doesn't tell you what your legal rights are. They don't tell you what your action might be, and they certainly don't tell you what the risk would be of moving forward with the case. So we worry about that provision. The problem with the Ag Extension Service on page 5 is that they really can't get to the courthouse unless you get a mediation release. And if the Extension Service doesn't get it, you really are barred from bringing a case in court. And that is, I think, really problematic. And I'll go a little quicker here, Mr. Chairman. You know, as you're in this mediation, you have to hire your own experts. You have to do all of your own work. You have to pay for the arbitrator. And that's all spelled out in the bill. Again, you have to get a mediation release from the Ag Extension Service as a condition precedent to filing a suit. And if you do run into problems and you can bring an action in court, I want you to look at page 8 on lines 8.24 to 2.7, and it tells you what the court can review. It's limited to whether the mediator committed an abuse of discretion in filing or failing to file an affidavit as it relates to a lack of good faith participation. Then, what the court can do in that instance is not say, okay, we're going to hear this case in court. What the court can do is they can send you back to mediation. They can order court-ordered mediation, which they can do right now, or they can require that you go back and restart the process. They don't allow you to commence a civil case to have your dispute heard in court. And the last thing I'll point out, Mr. Chair and members, is on Section 12, line 911, interesting, through 9.16. If you do get to court and you can have judicial review of this process, You get judicial review brought in equity, which is a term I haven't seen in legislation ever. A court of equity is one that doesn't have to deal with precedent, and they can make up whatever they want. That's a court of equity. They're not bound by the law or previous law. So you can go to a court and they can pretty much make up whatever they want in equity. And what they can review is whether or not, based on clear and convincing evidence, which is not beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's way above preponderance of the evidence, they can only review whether the decision of the director is an abuse of discretion. They can't review whether or not any remedy they fashioned was appropriate. They can't review whether or not you even had a hearing on your money damages. They can only review whether or not the decision of the mediator trained by the Extension Service was an abuse of their discretion. I would suggest, members, this just simply goes too far in taking away the property rights that we have. These are raw and emotional problems that some people have with their agricultural neighbors. And it's very rare that they don't get resolved and get brought into court. But this bill, as constructed, really moves us a far, far way away from what our legal remedies are and what our constitutional protections are in court. And we have very serious concerns about it. I've talked with the proponents. I know they want to make some changes to this, but there are a lot of serious issues in this bill that I hope you will consider. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer questions.
Before we go to questions, is there any other testifiers in the audience? Okay. Go the gal there, first gal, state your name and where you're from, and you'll have to come up to the mic. Do that for records.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sonia Traum Ayers. It's E-A-Y-R-S. I'm a family law attorney. I reside in Hennepin County. You heard me testify, many of you, last week. I grew up in Dodge County, Minnesota. I'm here this morning as a proud farmer's daughter, and I'm also a member of Dodge County Concerned Citizens. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 1221. This particular bill elevates the rights of industry to the detriment of family farmers like my parents. Our family has been in our family for nearly 125 years. But things changed dramatically 3 years ago when Dodge County approved the 11th swine factory farm within a three-mile radius of our farm. This one just a half mile west of our farm. By the way, the owner lives miles away, and that's what's happening in rural Minnesota. Many of these industrial operations are being thrown up on bare tracts of land where no one lives. And they don't have to smell the stench. But all the other neighbors that live in the area and those families that have been there for generations have to deal with the stench on a daily basis. In an instant, Dodge County changed over 100 years of history. The stench impacts our daily use and enjoyment of our family farm. That's what a nuisance action is defined. That's what defines a nuisance action. That's why we have rights under Minnesota law. No more family reunions, no more weddings, no more wedding receptions. Imagine the stench from not just one of these operations, but 11 in a three-mile radius. You have no idea what it's like when they roll up the curtains on these facilities at night. Hydrogen sulfide, methane, ammonia, and other dangerous gases are emitted from these facilities. My parents initiated their first lawsuit against Dodge County and the local factory farm operator 3 years ago. We've been in litigation for 3 years. There are two ways that you can fight one of these operations. The first is a permitting action. That's what my parents have been involved in. You're challenging the permit that the county did not meet the local ordinance, and you're challenging the issuance of that permit. The second way you fight installation of one of these operations is through a nuisance action. Once it's built, then you bring your lawsuit and you fight them on a nuisance basis. How many times The opposition has asked us to participate in mediation in the last 3 years. Zero. Precisely zero times that they have suggested mediation. As to House File 1221, it strips the rights of local and rural residents, many of whom have been on the land for generations, to fight installation of these large industrial feedlots. A nuisance action is the last recourse for local citizens to fight back. You cannot take away this right. As to the mediation provision, I'm a family law attorney. I have dealt for nearly 30 years with families who are going through divorce, terrible custody situations, and I've participated in dozens of mediations over the years. I'm very familiar with the ADR rules. They're here. They're in the Minnesota Rules of Court, Rule 114, that you heard referenced this morning. In fact, I'm on the ADR roster. I'm an ADR neutral in the state of Minnesota. All civil cases are subject to the ADR rules. And we heard an important exception this morning, an exception that applies to cases where there's domestic violence. And I see those cases on a daily basis. House File 1221 creates a separate and a completely new process for nuisance actions. It's not what's in here, folks. They want to create their own separate law that's going to govern these actions. The proposed legislation crafts an agreement that, number one, and first and foremost, the thing you need to take away with you home today, it's a delay tactic. Again, this is nothing more than a delay tactic that clearly favors the industry. Number two, it requires extensive mediation process that ultimately may not resolve the nuisance. Third, it forces parties to endure mediation conditions for up to 2 years while they're paying legal fees and floundering in the mediation process, which, by the way, the industry is going to have access to probably association funds while they fight this, while the neighbors are paying out of their own pockets. Fourth, it does not allow the aggrieved party to proceed in court. They're trying to take away our rights to proceed in court. And five, it essentially puts the mediator in a position where the mediator is acting as both judge and jury. In rural Minnesota, it's David versus Goliath. As farm families fight the industry and fight installation of these large industrial operations. It's an abusive situation. People are afraid to speak out because their jobs are threatened. Their businesses are threatened. I have an email that was sent to local citizen in my hometown of Blooming Prairie that I'd like to just read quickly. This is following our effort.
If we can, we have one more testifier, and we have to be out of here at 12 noon, please.
I appreciate that. Thank you. This is an email that was sent by a number of industry folks, probably 20 names on this list, to a local citizen in Blooming Prairie that signed a petition to put in place local planning and zoning. Several times it has been mentioned that some people will not buy anything in Blooming Prairie. I realize it is well within your personal rights to do as you wish. However, it will not be good for the businesses and the community if you lose any further credibility because of this issue. A feedlot battle is not something you should be involved in. We speak out because others cannot. I can tell you dozens of people who have had their jobs threatened, businesses threatened, even local newspapers are afraid to speak out on these issues. It's shameful what's happening in rural Minnesota. But we're not going to be afraid. This mediation provision is one more way for the industry to dominate and wear down aggrieved parties who are attempting to exercise their legal rights. Can you imagine forcing an abused wife to sit through 2 years of mediation while she has to sit and live with the abuser? That is exactly what you're doing here. You're forcing these farm families to have to live in this abusive situation for up to 2 years before they can bring an action. I respectfully request that you vote no to House File 1221. do not elevate the rights of an industry to the detriment of local farm families that are the backbone of this state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The other lady, if you can come down and share. We have about 3 minutes, so you'll have to keep your comments to 3 minutes, please. State your name for the record.
I'm Amy Goodwin. It might comfort you all to know that I'm not a lawyer.
Thank you.
Again, I'm Amy Goodwin. I'm from Todd County, Minnesota. Some of you might be aware of where Alexandria, Minnesota is. It's a high tourist place. We have a beautiful country up there, lots of lakes. I live in the heart of that, in the middle. I used to, I should say, live in the middle of a very agricultural community out in the wilderness. We live on some property that my husband had in his family for many years, and in the interest of time, I'm going to cut a lot of that short, but the land was deeded to us. We were living on this property. We had lived on this property for 20 years at the time. We had 4 sons. All of our memories were there. We had cut our home out of the wilderness there, literally. We had a hog facility that came to our neighborhood. And when it was first proposed, honestly, we weren't concerned. We both grew up on farms. We had rich agriculture in our area. Our closest neighbor actually was a hog farmer on a small scale and never had any issues. You know, it's part of what we love about where we live. It wasn't really until I started hearing some of the concerns of some of our neighbors that I became concerned. And my main reason I was concerned is because I started to read about some of the health issues that are associated with these facilities for close neighbors. Now, keeping in mind that we were just a little bit over 2,000 feet away from this proposed site for this facility, and we were the third farthest neighbor. There's actually 6 of us that were in within a half a mile from this facility. And so I did start looking into it, and I did call, you know, the Minnesota Department of Health and ask them my questions, and I did find that that being in close proximity to these large facilities is a problem for people with asthma. I have 2 sons with asthma. I have asthma myself, but my younger son had the more severe case of asthma, and so we did get involved in opposing this facility for that reason. I can tell you that from our perspective, we went through all of the correct channels. We went through all of our committees in our townships. We went through our committees in our commissioners' boards. We went to all the planning and zoning. We came down here to the MPCA. We did not want to end up where we ended up, and we tried very hard to not end up there. But alas, we did. Once the facility was brought in, once the animals were moved in, it's a very large facility. We really just were hoping that it wouldn't be as bad as we thought it would be. I mean, and we truly were hoping for that. We did not want to leave our home of 20 years. We did not want that. But very quickly, within just a matter of weeks, my youngest son became quite sick. He very quickly was 100% dependent on his asthma inhalers and his nebulizers to keep his air free. And that was a huge concern of ours. He couldn't play outside anymore. He couldn't wait for the bus anymore. I had to drive him down the driveway. And it really, at first, fueled us to just continue the fight, to do whatever we could, because we did not want to leave our home. We did not. One night, I heard my son running downstairs, and it was frantic in just his footsteps. And I met him at the bottom of the stairs, and I caught him when he fell. And he was in the worst asthma attack that I had seen him. And he was not able to breathe. And he was hitting his chest with his fist to get his air because he couldn't breathe. And as a mother, knowing that the closest hospital was 20 minutes away, and seeing that my son's lips were blue, you can imagine what that was like for us. And that was the day that the fight was over. It didn't matter how long we lived in our house. It didn't matter how much we loved our home. The fight was over because we would not make him go through that anymore. We left our home, and we paid 2 mortgages for 7 months, and it broke us. I almost did not come in here today because this is so difficult, and we're almost 3 years out, and we've tried so hard to put this behind us, We really have, and we've done a good job. We've rebuilt our lives, and we have survived financial ruin. We have survived heartbreak, and I almost didn't come here today, but I came because I wanted you to see my face, and I want you to remember my face when you are passing this kind of legislation, because we had no other option. We did not want to end up where we ended up, and we did. And from where I'm standing, this bill and others like it that we've seen so far is like taking the pebbles from our hands and handing them to the giant, for which he will further pummel us with. And I'm begging you not to do that, because we have precious few pebbles to protect ourselves with at this point. And I'm begging you not to do that. And I'm asking that you will support legislation that is fair. And then when you look at my face, I want you to times it by 100, because I am not alone. There are many across Minnesota who are going through just as horrible things that I went through, and that's the real tragedy of the story, is not the horribleness that we went through, but that we aren't alone, that there's so many. And as long as you pass legislation that allows this to happen, it will continue to happen. I ask you to please invite us to that table. I do believe there is common ground. I do believe there are places that we can coexist with these facilities and with neighbors, but I believe that we have to be invited to that table in order for that to be fair legislation. And I just beg you not to further hinder us. And just like the pork producers are asking, he said they want equal rights under the law. And that's all we're asking for. That's all we want. Thank you.
Thank you. With us on that time, we do appreciate you sharing your story. I lay over House File 1221. We are in recess until 6 p.m. or the call of the chair. And right now we are meeting in room 500 north unless we find a bigger room. Thank you.
Meeting back to order of the House Agriculture Policy Committee. And because members may be shuffling in and out tonight at other committees, we're going to change the schedule a little bit to make sure we can have people back on both sides when we take some votes. So first up, because he has to go back to another committee, we'll have Representative Backer with House File 1165. Mr. Backer, would you like to move your bill, Representative Backer?
Yeah, I move that House File 1165 is referred to Committee of Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. And I also have an A1 amendment.
Sure. Representative Backer has the A1 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
I would like to move that amendment.
Representative Backer moves the amendment. Any questions on the amendment, the A1 amendment to House File 1165? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. The amendment is approved. Mr. Representative Backer, please present your bill as amended.
Yeah, this is a very simple bill. This bill was brought to me by some industry individuals. And what it does is, if you look on the bill, line 2.21, it eliminates the gross income of $15,000. So before, if you made anything over $15,000, you were not eligible for this. And so, of course, a lot of people these days make over $15,000. So, in essence, it was a mute thing for getting legal assistance. And then the second thing that we do here is we also establish guidelines under Section 480.243. It's up to, if they want to do 125%, or go up to 200%. So it's just some technical changes there. And then, of course, this bill gives legal aid for farmers in financial challenges and crisis. So that's what this bill does.
Thank you, Representative. And I would add that this kind of came out of the Farmer Lender Mediation Commission. Yep. They had a recommendation that it was more difficult for farmers sometimes to access some reduced price or free legal aid. So that's the reason this bill has come forward, and thank you for carrying it, Representative Backer.
Yep, thank you.
Any members have questions on the bill? Anybody in the audience care to testify for or against House File 1165? Seeing none, Vice Chair Backer, any final comments on your bill?
Well, I would ask for your support. And then I renew my motion that House File 1165, as amended, be referred to the Committee of Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance.
All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried, and the bill is passed. Thanks, Representative.
Okay. I guess we... Okay, I'm Chair Anderson. The next bill on the agenda is House File 199. Members, there are two amendments in your package that was adopted to this bill on February 15th. Representative Anderson, please move your bill as amended to get it before the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I also have a delete all amendment someplace in my packet here. Should be here.
Okay. Well,
yes, sir.
Thank you. It is the DE1 amendment.
Yeah, if you would like to move your amendment at this time, you can. I'm sure, Anderson. Okay, first of all, I'm sorry. I've been advised that we have to move the bill first. So let's first, Representative Anderson moves the House File 199 as amended be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance. Now, Representative Anderson, you have a DE1 amendment.
Yeah, I do, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move your amendment at this time?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson moves that the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape he wants it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you may not recognize this bill from what we had last week, the week before. Talked to a lot of folks and tried to make some changes and make the bill such that folks would agree to go along with it and yet not be so burdensome on extension or a university or counties or townships or whatever. So what we came up with was the language on the bottom, 1.13 and 1.14, that the Ag Commissioner would post a notice on his website and in appropriate ag media, which I feel is important, when a weed on the eradicate list is confirmed for the first time in any county in Minnesota. So if that occurs, we hope it doesn't, but if it does, it would be publicized by the Commissioner and... In that way, folks in the area would know that, in this case, Palmer Amaranth is in the county. And that was the intent, anyway, of the bill, to get notification out to people. And this bill does that. Also, at the earlier meeting, the nursery and landscape folks had some issues with the bill. They have contacted me, and they are in support of this amendment, Mr. Chair. So I would ask members to support this DE amendment.
Does anyone in the audience wish to testify on the DE1 amendment? Okay, I'm sorry. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on or behalf of the bill as amended, House File 199? Okay, Chair Anderson, final comments.
No, Mr.
Chair. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see. Representative Mahoney, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, on page 1, line 14, you talk about agricultural media. Can you give me a little bit more definition of that? Is that a newspaper? Is that a magazine? and how often and how large?
Chair Anderson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, what comes to mind, there are some excellent market, farm market programs on radio. A couple of times a day, Linder Farm Network comes to mind, and I would assume that radio, being as fast as it is, would be the obvious place for the announcements to be made. So that would be my intention to what media would be. Magazines, newspaper is a little bit slow, I think, in terms of getting the word out there right away. So I would assume that to mean electronic media, websites, and radio.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, this, anytime you purchase an ad on radio, I'm going to take that back and rephrase it. Anytime you put a press release out, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to, any particular audience or radio station or TV station or anybody else is going to pick it up. Otherwise, I'd be the most famous politician in St. Paul, because I put them on all the time and nobody listens. what's that? Are you envisioning them having to pay for any of this media?
I'm Chair Anderson.
The short answer is no. This would be a newsworthy item, and I'm pretty confident that these radio ag reports would put that on the air as a service to their listeners.
Mr. Chair,
follow up, Representative.
I think what you're trying to do is the right thing, and I hope that works. And I know that sometimes when we try to get too much direction, we step on our own toes. But I really do believe your agricultural media piece there needs a little bit more fleshing out, sometime between here and the floor. Any omnibus bill you put in?
Any comments on that, Chair Anderson?
Well, I appreciate those comments, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. But again, in our smaller market, again, I'll say radio stations, this would be a very newsworthy item if this weed were found any place in the particular county. And again, I can't say with 100% certainty that it would be put on the air, for example, but unless you would buy ads, that's the only way you could guarantee it. And again, we'd want to get this out there as quickly as possible, and I think the Ag Commissioner contacting or his staff contacting a local radio station would carry some weight. But I will look at it and talk to the Commissioner's office and see what they'd recommend in terms of the assurance of getting it in the ag media. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Anderson, thank you for simplifying, clarifying, and improving the bill quite a bit. I do think, just related to the ag media, in agriculture, people would know what radio station they're going to listen to. They're going to know the farm market report. They're going to know, they're going to get agri news. They're going to have, there's going to be a number of opportunities for them. So I'm not sure that you could necessarily improve this a great deal, because if you started to list places, I mean, there may be something that you wouldn't list, because the local radio station in my area would share that, and you wouldn't have all of that. But I don't know if you'd want to have, you know, including radio, you know, newspaper and other areas, if that's the kind of clarification you're trying to get at. But I would think that, as Chair Anderson has said, this is a newsworthy item, and if you're paying attention to the issue, you are going to make sure that you hear about it, and the radio stations would certainly be including that. But I just wanted to thank you for cleaning this bill up, and happy to support it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree, Representative Anderson, there's a better bill. My question is, I'm just thinking, well, okay, the announcement comes out, and it's, you know, and it's in a county that would be identified. That would beg the question on the listener, where in the county is it? Have you thought through what the next step may be, or is it relevant to this legislation? You just let, yeah. Any thoughts on that?
Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, you know, as you recall, the earlier bill had to notify adjoining landowners and got a lot of pushback on that, which kind of surprised me, but it was what it was. And I think even with county notification, a farmer is going to be on guard a little bit more. He's going to walk out and maybe check his CRP or his grassland or his buffer strips, whatever, and be on the lookout for the weed. Township may be better, but again, with the comments we got back on the bill, and there was also some talk about a farmer being a little bit embarrassed if he had the weed on his land and might not want to share with anybody. And I don't see that, because this weed is coming in from out of state, and it's really nobody's fault if it shows up on my land, for example, if it's in contaminated grass seed that I got for a project. So I didn't quite agree with that, but that's what the message that was given to me. Didn't want it to be quite as specific. So we settled on countywide notification, and I think that'll do the job of at least making the farmers aware that it's in the area anyway.
Thank you.
Representative Norris, did you have a question?
I was just going to throw out a thought here dealing with the contact of the media. I'm assuming that the commissioner's office, as they've been notified about this situation, would probably contact specifically the county so they could direct the media, the radio station, everybody in that area to be on the alert as kind of the first call. Not necessarily statewide, but at least alert the county where it's been located. And to me, that'd be quite simple to do. They would just issue a press release, get on the radio. It would be quick and very effective. So I think the bill doesn't specifically say how to do it, but I think it's easy to have it figured out. So.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any other? Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the same vein, I think that if the commissioner or anybody of authority calls the news media and says, this is what has happened and we'd like you to include it in your news, they'll, by attribution, they'll identify who it's coming from. And I think I'm smart enough to, if I heard this on the radio, I would know enough to call the attribution, you know. So I'd be calling wherever I thought would be the source of that piece from the news, and I'd find out the information I needed. So I think it's actually quite adequate.
Good. Thank you for your comment. Any other questions or comments from members? Okay, Chair Anderson, do you have any final comments?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. I think we had some questions asked and some comments made, and I appreciate the support of the bill, so I renew my motion that House File 199, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevailed. The next bill on the agenda is House File 983. Representative Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill to put it before the committee?
Yeah, I move House File 983 to put it before the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I do. Would you like to speak to the bill before we bring up testifiers?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah. This bill was brought to me in an effort to clear up a statute that's currently in law having to do with where somebody who provides feed for livestock would fall in this chain of command, if you will, of lien. First place, second place, and so on down the line. And there was some confusion with a couple of court cases, and it was thought that this bill would clarify that situation and give a person who provides feed for livestock a strong position, a first position, and would make sure that he would get paid for feed he hauls out to a livestock operation. So that's the basis for the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure there's a couple of folks that would like to talk about it.
Sure. Is Bob Zelka?
Zelenka,
thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We've been around. In fact, our convention, 110th convention, is tomorrow. So I should really be there at this point, but I'd essentially rather be here at this legislation before you. We represent grain elevators and feed mills in the state of Minnesota. We have approximately 9,000 employees statewide. We have grain elevators and feed mills in over 500 small towns around the state of Minnesota. And I'm here today, I guess, as a result of issues that we've encountered recently with the lien. It's called a feeder lien. Feeder lien has been in statute for 40, 50 years. I forget how long. But what the feeder lien we thought we had was a automatic priority for the value of the feed. And when we're filing, so it's a way to mitigate our risk, if you will, by being able to file a lien when we're providing feed. What's happened is there's been some recent court actions where they're looking at this current statute, and there's been some confusion and ambiguity in the law. And what we're attempting to do in this legislation is address the ambiguity that was actually referenced in the case law that the courts have been referring to, which is the First National Bank versus Profit Pork. They mentioned in that case that there's the feeder lien has a lot of ambiguity in it. So what we were attempting to do in this legislation is to add some clarifying language to the feeder lien portion of the statute to make it clear that feeding has always been mentioned in there, what we're trying to do is to clarify that feed provided by a feed mill to a livestock operation, you would be able to file a lien through the feeder lien and have a priority for the value of the feed provided. And what happened was in 1986, and I was around for that as well, in 1986 there was what was called an ag input lien was put into law. We were pursuing a priority lien for not feed, but at that time fertilizer and seed and so on. The bankers kind of stepped in, and we had to back away from getting a priority lien on that ag input lien. Hopefully I'm not confusing you, but my point is that in 1986 there was an ag input lien that was put into law. And about 15 years ago, that ag input lien, for whatever reason, was added to the feeder lien. So now you have two liens in one statute. And so when the courts go to the statute, they look at the feeder lien, which in our opinion does provide priority, and the ag input lien. It's called a livestock lien, titled in there, but it functions exactly the same as the ag input lien that was put in place in 1986. Long story short, feeder lien, you have an automatic priority when you file the lien and perfect the lien. Under an ag input lien or this livestock input lien, you only get a priority if the lenders either do not respond to your notice in 10 days, or they decide to give you a priority, or if they screw up and don't respond in 10 days, that's the only time you get a priority lien. So how many times do the lenders subordinate and give you a priority? Very seldom. Have there been occasions where the lenders did not respond in 10 days? It has happened. But the problem is that by referencing these two liens in this one statute, it's confusing. And what we're suggesting is, in addition to the language we're talking about adding here to address the ambiguity, we're talking about removing that reference to that ag input lien. It has its own statute. We're not eliminating it from that statute. We're eliminating its reference in this statute to make it clearer, so if we have to go to court, that we have a better standing in the court. Our concern right now is that we're seeing farmer lender mediation at close to an all-time high. And that is real disconcerting to people providing feed to livestock operations. And without feed, the collateral that the banks have no value. So we have an important role to play in providing feed to livestock, keeping them alive. And we feel we need to have an additional protection, clearer protection, in this statute to mitigate the risk that we're encountering by providing feed to these livestock operations. So that's basically why we're here, asking for your support to address a situation that is confusing in this statute. We're trying to make it more, less ambiguous and to help us to again, mitigate the risk that we're facing on a daily basis here. So with that, I do have a member of ours that asked to come up to testify as well, and I don't know how you want to proceed, Mr. Chairman, but...
Brad?
Brad Stenzel?
Stenzel, yeah.
Do you want him to testify?
I have him next on the list, so... Okay. Members...
Let's see the question. I don't know how you want to proceed.
No, members, we're going to hold questions until Al has testified, so if Mr. Stenzel could come up, we would appreciate that.
Okay, thanks.
And for the record, state your name and who you're representing for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Brad Stenzel, a family-owned business in southern Minnesota, 25 miles north of Alfred Lea. It's a family business, been over 40 years in business, and basically I wrote some notes down so I can go from to remember them all. So we had a case that we went through, and it was a $35,000 amount that was we had to forgive. Have you ever wondered why we can't win in the court systems for feeder liens and UCC filings? You can have both of these in place and still not win. It is rigged to give you false hope. We are told these two things will protect us, but it isn't so. I had both of these in place and still lost. I got to thinking, when I'm at the bank talking to my banker officer and asking what I'm doing about risk management on my accounts receivables, I sat down and thought for a while and realized I really don't have a true risk management plan. The things like getting the producer's balance sheet to determine what his line of credit would be, or have customers sign guarantees for the line of credit we would give to them, or the information we collect off the credit application. After we called all the references and their bank, and they still give you information that doesn't really protect us. I really think the banking system knows this and has put us at risk. With knowing this, the question is, how do we really protect ourselves? The one thing we need to realize, we are not a bank. Then I came to the conclusion we can do an irrevocable letter of credit from the bank to establish a line of credit for our customer. That would protect the company and put the responsibility where it should be. Even the banks don't like irrevocable line of credit, and it costs the producers a lot of money to do that with the bank, and it kind of makes more credit than they actually need. So that's all I have. So.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Yeah. We have David Skillbred. If you can come forward. Testify.
Hi.
You don't look like David.
Thank you. He's much better looking, I must say. David and I just thought that if we could change the order a little bit, that might be okay. My name's John Appitz, and I represent Farm Credit Services here at the Minnesota Legislature. And I've got a couple comments about this. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to the group. Let me first say the Farm Credit Services, which provides credit, both operating credit and real estate credit across Minnesota and across the country, makes probably half of the real estate loans and a third of the production loans in the state of Minnesota, is adamantly opposed to this legislation. And we're adamantly opposed to this legislation because it's not a simple clarification. This is not a clarification. The case that you heard about, Profit Pork, was very clear in its holding with regard to the order of priority and the order that priority when you're looking at payment of bills, when you're looking at repayments in situations where collateral has been collateral has been liquidated for one reason or the other. It's about the order in which creditors get paid. And this attempts to change that order in a rather dramatic fashion And it could actually have some rather severe consequences for the livestock lending industry. Let me give you just a little history behind the statute, if I might. Because in 2001, I can't believe it, but in 2001 I did sit on the task force that brought legislation forward, tried to work with all these different means that were in place back then, and figure out a priority amongst the competing priorities that there were, and make sure that the public generally knew about the priorities that were brought forward. Before 2001, there were a lot of just what we call statutory liens that were on the books. They were liens that existed simply because you did something. They didn't have to be registered, they didn't have to be filed, and they arose when there was a dispute over whether or not somebody was going to be paid for services or for credit that they had provided. What the task force attempted to do was two things: set up an order in which liens would be, debtors would be paid, creditors would be paid, and make all that public so that people who lent, provided service or lent money knew the order in which they would fall when collateral was liquidated. In some situations, there were greater priority given for services that were rendered. For instance, if a veterinarian provided a service that saved the life of a livestock in some form or another, that veterinarian would get a lien that was a priority ahead of the lien that came before it. But in most instances, the situation was that if you were first in time, you were first in right. It's just kind of a standard operating procedure. If you filed your lien, the next person knew that you had a lien ahead of them. They would file a lien, the next person, the next person. So first in time, first in right was basically the standard, and everybody had to file. So it was publicly disclosed at the Secretary of State's office. What this would do is turn a portion of that on its head. What was done in the instance of the feeder's lien, ag input lien and a feeder's lien, was to differentiate amongst those. But an ag input lien is a first-in-time, first-in-right lien. So if a supplier of feed, you lend money for the herd, to establish the herd. You take collateral in the herd. Next in line is a feeder. The feeder wants priority on the money that they lend. They file that lien, etc. What this bill would attempt to do is then if there was some dispute over whether or not the feeder was able to feed and get a priority, they'd send a note to the lender that's in the statute, and it says, the envelope says, very important information, read this, lender. And the lender can decide whether or not they want to subordinate their lien or whether or not they're going to not allow a subordination. Now, at times, lenders won't subordinate a lien. And why won't they subordinate a lien? Because maybe there's not enough credit in the collateral to repay all the liens, or a variety of other reasons. But that's the mechanism that's used today. That's the mechanism that's been used for 15 years, and it's a mechanism that maintains that priority and yet allows for a feed input supplier to get a priority if the lender allows that. This would turn that on its head. This would basically say, you don't have to ask. You simply have to provide the feed, and within 60 days after that feed is provided, you can go and file a lien. So essentially, what you've got is a situation where a lender can stop providing credit, and the feed supplier can continue providing that feed, and they can provide as much feed as they want, being assured that they're going to get paid because they have a priority lien once they file that lien. That basically jumps right over the top of the lender who's there in the first place. I know this is a little arcane and goes on at some length, but let me just put it like this. It would be a lot like giving a plumber who provided services in your house a priority lien over the mortgage holder, over the banker who made you the loan in the first place. That would be an analogy that would kind of fit. And we're thinking if feed suppliers believe that they should continue, well, I know some members here might not have a problem with that, but some possibly would. Pipes are important, that's true. Mr. Chairman, so feed suppliers believe they should continue to provide feed to the producers. They should negotiate an agreement with the holder of the competing interest. If the lender is not willing to do so, that should send a clear signal to that feed supplier that continuing financing of the producer might not make good economic sense. So
changing the law isn't a small deal. Changing the law isn't a clarification. Changing the law changes something the legislature decided on 15 years ago after a lot of thought and study. And it's not really fair, it's not reasonable, and it has some potentially damaging outcomes to boot. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. We have Jim Girard. Oh, David, are you going? Did you want also? I thought he testified. If you want to come up, you can come up, Mr. Steelbraith. I thought he took your place and kicked you out.
He does that once more.
Okay. Well, we'll let you
but
in.
It's okay.
You can have the last word this way.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. David Steelbraith. I represent independent community banks around the state. We have over 300 charters and over 500 locations in the urban, suburban, and rural areas. About three-fourths of our members are in rural Minnesota, and ag lending is a probably our top niche. Risk was mentioned, and I would like to talk just a little bit about that. As the lawyer, Mr. Athens, just described, the way this would be set up is that a feeder could provide a feed to livestock, and that livestock might be collateral for loans at one of my banks. And they could continue to provide that feed as long as they wanted, and then only notify the bank 60 days after the last delivery. During all of that time, if that livestock is collateral for one of my members, that collateral is decreasing by the retail value of the feed provided. Now, maybe it's a day. That's not going to make too much difference. What if it's a week, a month, 3 months, 6 months? It could add up to be a very sizable amount of money. What that then does then is, if that would be law, then when lenders make new loans under a new system like this, they're going to have to figure in that risk. And the risk is going to be increased and could cause some very drastic results, as Mr. Appert said. One of them might be that when all things are considered, a loan for a livestock purchase is not going to be made. There's too much risk involved. Or likewise, if a farmer comes in and wants to use livestock as collateral, now that collateral has less value than before, and perhaps the banker might not want to use it at all as collateral. Even if it isn't for a livestock loan, but rather for a different type of ag loan. So lending and the ability to get loans is going to be decreased. Secondly, there was mention about farmer lender mediation and how the number of notices are going up. When you hear about this, which you might in the coming weeks or months, please keep in mind that when notices are going out, one notice does not equal one farm. One notice equals a co-owner of a farm. So if you have four brothers or four sisters or whatever that own one farm, they each get a notice. So if 2,000 notices go out, which was about the number in 2015, that does not mean that the 2,000 farms are being affected. It's far less than that. So keep that in mind, because that's something that we will talk about. I think with that, I'll just say one more thing, and that is a comment was made previously by Mr. Zelenka that when they feed that livestock, they're preserving the collateral of the bank. Well, if that livestock is our collateral, we're going to feed it, and we're going to make sure that it gets feed and that livestock remains healthy. Because that is our collateral, and it's also a moral obligation. So the inference that the livestock will not get fed unless this change is made is not right. With that, I'll quit. Take questions if you have.
Okay, we're going to do the one more testifier, and then we'll take questions. So, thank you. Mr. Jim Gerald. Gerard, I'm sorry. Thank you. Go ahead. Please state your name and who you're with and share us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Jim Gerard, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. The good news is I found out I was testifying as I walked in the door, so that means my testimony is much shorter than everyone else's.
Thank you.
I do believe you should have a memo from the Minnesota Bankers Association that outlines the concerns we have with the bill. We are willing to work with the author and the and Mr. Zelenka and the other organizations to come to an agreement that might work better than the bill that's been introduced. But we appreciate your time, and like I say, we're willing to work with whoever we need to make sure that the livestock get fed properly. Thank you.
Does anyone else wish to testify for or against House File 983? Questions from members? Representative Anderson, do you have any further comments? Chair Anderson?
Mr. Chair, these concerns with the bill have just come up in the last couple of days, and I respect those concerns, and I think we need to address those concerns before this bill moves on. What has been talked about here is very important in terms of livestock health, number one, but also our banking and lending system. So I would like to pause for a couple of days here and have the parties get together and attempt to come up with a solution that works, that would give the feeders a little bit more comfort and yet keep the lien procedure in place that the bankers could live with as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would move to lay this bill on the table.
Okay. Lay it over. House on File 983 is laid over. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 1545. Chair Anderson, would you like to move this bill on Representative Hamilton's behalf?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm on behalf of Chair Hamilton, I move that House File 1545 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Okay, Representative Anderson moves that the House File 1545 be referred to the Committee of GovOps and Elections. Chair Anderson, please present Representative Hamilton's bill.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a simple one, so this should be pretty easy. What this bill does, it simply, Section 1 extends the Food Safety and Defense Task Force for another 10 years. This is one of these commissions that comes around once every 10 years. I believe there's some federal requirements and such, so this needs to be extended. And the bill extends that through June 30th of 2027. And in Section 2 of the bill, it adds small animals to the definition of animals under the meat inspection chapter. And the reason for that, there's a growing segment of the meat industry among immigrant cultures to include such things as rabbit and guinea pig. So the word small, or two words small animals, is being added to the definition of animals in Section 2. And Mr. Chairman, that's what the bill does.
Okay, good. Is there any testifiers for or against House File 1545? Okay, go ahead. Please state your name and who you're with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Whitney Place. I'm with the Department of Agriculture, and these are two initiatives included in the agency's policy bill, and we really appreciate the committee's support on them.
Okay, thank you. Short. We appreciate that. Is there any other testifiers for or against House File 1545? Okay. Questions from members? Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, reading your bill, you said you added the word small, but I think you might have misspoken. You're just taking out the word large, which would then include small? On page 1, line 11.
Chair Anderson.
Hey, Mr. Chair and Representative, can't get anything past you, can we?
We should talk to Gunther. That was worse in his committee.
Yeah, you seem to be correct. The word large is stricken, and what the crib sheet notes I got from Chair Hamilton said they what it does is add small animals. But yeah, okay.
Well, looks like Representative Mahoney's keeping on your toes, Chair. Okay. Any other questions from members? Okay, good. Representative Chair Anderson, do you have any final comments?
No, it's duly noted that wording strikes the one word, but the meaning is still there. So no further word, Mr. Chair. I'd renew my motion that House File 1545 be referred to the Committee of Government Operations and Elections.
Okay, members, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevailed. Chair Anderson moves that House File 1221 be referred to Committee on Civil Law and Data Practice. So we're going back to the bill that we didn't finish. Are you ready, Chair Anderson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and we were hearing testimony this morning when we ran out of time, so I'd assume we would just continue hearing testimony here this evening.
I don't know if there was any. I guess I'll start. If there is any for or against, go ahead if you want to come up, and please state your name and who you're with, and be factual and precise, please.
I will be very brief. Sonia Traumers, I testified this morning. I'm here on behalf of Dodge County Concerned Citizens. And we have a website, by the way, dodgecc.org. I would encourage all of you to take a look or look at our Facebook page. We have serious concerns about industrial agriculture and the serious problems that it's causing in Minnesota. But I am here. I failed to mention this morning. I have four statements that were prepared by other individuals like our family who are on the front lines and are dealing head-on with industrial animal agriculture. The first is from Dale Schmeling. Dale also resides in Dodge County. He is surrounded by over 30,000 pigs in a two-mile radius. His first-hand statement. These people are all brave, by the way, for speaking out, and they represent hundreds of people that are behind them. Yes, please. The second is from Christy Rosenquist. She is a resident of Zumbrota Township, Goodhue County. And another one also from Zumbrota Township in Goodhue County, Jed Post. Both of these individuals are directly impacted by a large swine facility that was just recently approved. And there, I understand that there is a lawsuit now that has been filed. So those two additional affidavits or written statements. And then the fourth is from a woman, Lori DeRozier. And Lori and her family live in Stockholm Township, Wright County, just west of the metro out on Highway 12. And their family has been directly impacted by a 1.65 million chicken facility. These are all people who are directly impacted by the nuisance bill and this mediation provision. And so I would ask that you take time and read their statements. Thank you.
Thank you. Any others in the audience to testify for or against that didn't be due before?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carpenter, I'm here if you have questions. So we don't
need questions. Okay, good. Members, questions? You wanted to testify? State your name and where you're from, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and I do work with the Minnesota Pork Producers and had discussions with Representative Anderson, and he'd indicated like me to talk about a few pieces in here. First of all, I find it kind of interesting. I don't know how many, I actually don't have a clue as to who on this committee may or may not be a lawyer, but I don't know if there are any or not. But in any case, oftentimes committees are asked to make decisions about things, and different committees have different expertise. And quite frankly, I thought most of the issues relative to the mediation and so forth would be in the Civil Law Committee, not in the Agriculture Committee so much. First of all, even though many would indicate that pork producers around the state, and there are thousands of them, that somehow they are kind of the evildoers of the communities. But I want to assure you that these are family farmers too, many of them. Not, not all. There are people involved with the pork industry that are not. But most of the people out there are people that are large producers. That's true. And if you want to use the word factory farm, that's a that can be coined, I suppose, as to indicate to some method of the way pork production takes place. And that is generally considered in confinement. But there are many people out there that are trying to start the next generation of farmers. And in order to do so, they have to be larger than the previous generation often. Now, Minnesota is a very high producer of hog production in the country. I believe we're number two or three, at least. I think it's number two now in the United States. And so we do have a lot of hog production around the country, and part of the reason for that is because there's a lot of things that contribute to that. We have a very good University of Minnesota a veterinarian school that works with our producers. We also have got some very cheap corn and soybeans as an example on the end of the line that is there. There's a lot of reasons that hog production is in Minnesota. And in generally, one of the reasons that hog production also is in Minnesota is because most hog producers do try to work in their communities. Now, I understand that some people have got problems with living in a rural area and things have changed and so forth. And believe me, I do not go without having empathy for some of these situations. And I'm sure there are situations in which things can go wrong. But this legislature for many, many years has operated under the idea of local control. And we have that with regard to townships being involved in this process, counties being involved in this process, county feedlot officers. We also have the state in the terms of we have EAWs for people when they get so large. We have 70-20 feedlot rules. I think they're like 72 pages to describe how a person can operate and so forth. So don't get the idea that people just willy-nilly, indiscriminately operate. I happened to have a discussion recently with Representative Johnson, and we agreed on one thing, and that was that people try generally to find a way to work out their differences. That isn't true of everyone, just as it isn't when you go down the street and some guy pulls ahead of you and sideswipes you along the way because he's in too big of a hurry. Not everybody always agrees. But generally in rural Minnesota, we try to agree, and that was part of the impetus behind this bill. We've had several lawyers that have come ahead of this committee, they've come ahead of the Senate committee, and they've done a very lawyerly job of discussing this legislation. And it's easy sometimes when you bring a bill out to find holes in it and find things that are wrong. But I will tell you this, at least with Mr. Carlson, I think he verified this morning that I had made an offer to him to try and work with him if there were things wrong in the mediation section, that we would try to work those things out before it went to civil law. We are offering to try and work with this. There are a few provisions in here. For instance, the judicial review provision was copied from the Iowa law, but I'm told that is unnecessary. I think Mr. Carlson indicated at one point that it was some problems here and there, and I have put together an amendment that may or may not, because we haven't had a chance to discuss it, deal with certain things, but we're at least trying to, from our side, to try and work out some of the differences, concerns that people have got, because I'm certain this legislation is not perfect. In 1986, I served in the agricultural finance area, and I was one of those that worked on farmer lender mediation. And farmer-lender mediation went through several committees, and it went through conference committees and all the kinds of things that you deal with today. And I can tell you that it changed many times, and that's part of this process. Our belief was that when this bill came before this particular committee, an ag policy committee, that basically it was to deal with two things from a policy standpoint. One, should farmers of all types be treated equally under the law? And we pointed out, for instance, I think Mr. Pricer pointed out that in the existing law, a law which is originated in about 1981 or two, I happen to know that because I was the chief author of the bill at the time it was put into law. That particular law has withstood the test of time, I guess. It was pointed out, I know, by Mr. Carpenter this morning that in Iowa that there was a challenge to the Iowa law and it was struck down as being unconstitutional, and I appreciate the fact that he stated that that could happen in Minnesota, but it had not happened up to this point, and it was he was unaware as to how a judge, Supreme Court or whatever, might rule on that kind of a thing, and that's true. But one of the tenets that is in this bill, or one of the pieces that's in this bill, the main portion of the bill actually, is on page 1. And what it says, the provisions of this subdivision do not apply, and we're reading from the existing statute, not something that we're proposing, but there is a provision in the existing statute to an animal facility with a swine capacity of 1,000 or more. Now, I've talked to a number of lawyers as well, and I'm sure I could bring 5 in and get 5 different answers. But what has been pointed out to me, that if there's a provision in the existing law that could be challenged in court, it is the fact that it doesn't treat people equally under the law. And so one piece of this bill is to eliminate that portion, so that whether you're a hog producer, a cattle producer, a turkey producer, a chicken producer, whatever you are, that you're treated equally relative to this size limitation idea. And that is the major portion of this bill, and it's on page 1. But before you get there, recognize, and we're talking about existing law and not changing any proposal, because quite frankly, at least with that, if you discard the mediation portion, and I will talk to that in a second. If you're talking about that change in the law, what you have to do is to be located in an agriculturally zoned area in existing law, comply with the provisions of all applicable federal, state, or county laws, regulations, rules, and ordinances, and any permits issued for the agricultural operation. Now, that's not any small number. I totally understand that not everybody agrees with every decision that comes out of a county commissioner's, with county commissioners or township officers or the state of Minnesota through the MPCA. But this legislature, over 20 years, has put together quite a group of laws dealing with feedlots, which includes 70-some pages, I believe, of 70-20 rules that tell you how you can apply manure, where you must apply manure, how you have to lay out your operation, how it must be built, and so forth. And we have EAWs for over 1,000 animal units that do indicate additional things in which the state looks at it. But the county does the same thing. They have permits on the county level. And we, or you as legislators, over the years, over a period of about 20 years, have put together those requirements. So when the statute was changed over the years with regard to the right to farm law, it was called, one of the things that was put in was something called rebuttable presumption. And if you read the existing statute, which is the first page of your bill, you'll see that for a period of 2 years from its established date of operation, there's a rebuttable presumption that an agricultural is in compliance with the requirements of paragraph A, 1, 2, 3, is not a public or private nuisance. The reason at least previous legislatures wrote that into the law was to say, with all of the things that are out there in order to try and safeguard the public, and I will be the first to say that it may not always happen, but to try and say, or at least in agreement, some people would think it does happen and others would argue with that, but the point is that all of the laws that are on the books, it was the belief of the legislature that if you followed all the laws, all the regulations, you didn't break any of them, you did everything you were told to do, from state, federal, NPDES permits, SDS permits on the state level, EAWs, notifications, all these things on and down, that it was presumed, that's how I always looked at it, it was presumed that you would not be a nuisance. And that you would then be able, but there is an entry point here, and the entry point is within the first 2 years, that you would be able to look at a rebuttable presumption, which is to say, you could petition with the court to say, even though the state has got all of these things, the county, the whatever, even though that's there, if you can prove that there is still a nuisance above and beyond all those things, you have a, basically a two-year window with which then to do it. After that point in time, it becomes a matter of law that you are not a nuisance. And that exists for all agricultural operations, and this law started out in the early 80s and has been in the books for a long time. Now, there have been changes over the years. But that is the law today. The one thing left, though, was this idea of should you differentiate by size. So that's as much as I need to say about that. And it's really just simply a decision, a policy decision. Do you think you should differentiate by size if you're, if the person is totally complying with all of the regulations and laws and so forth? And recognizing that as you get larger, there are additional layers that are taken on by state government and by county governments in particular that require more and more as you get larger. That's, the, in theory, the protection of using local government to try and protect our citizens. Beyond that, though, there's a second thing. And quite frankly, I have been surprised at the level of angst over the mediation section. Earlier today, you passed a farmer lender mediation section of law. Much of this bill relative to the mediation was copied after what was in the farmer lender section. Now, when I was on the conference committee that wrote the farmer lender, and I'm going to tell you something about farmer lender. You have renewed it, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 times. When it was passed originally, it had a two-year sunset, and that's why you keep adding the sunsets. But let me tell you why that sunset was there. Because it was talked about earlier today about this particular idea of being something that could be unconstitutional. Well, the reason the sunset was there originally was because there's a provision in the state constitution that says that you cannot change contracts between parties. So the idea that the creditors and the borrowers, you then inserted, the legislature inserted the farmer lender in there as a way to bring the two sides together. And why? Because at that time, bankers were murdered in this state. I can tell you that's a fact. And farmers committed suicide. I had three of them that were my neighbors. Now, I'm not here to talk about farmer lender, but I'm only explaining kind of the background of that relative to this, and maybe that's why people have liked it so much over the years. But the one provision that was in there was the two-year sunset. The reason the two-year sunset was there was because there's another provision in the Constitution that says that you cannot change contracts between individuals, and that law does, time-wise, unless there's an emergency, a declaration of emergency. And that went way back to Floyd D. Olson in the 30s when he made a declaration of emergency under a similar situation as the farm crisis of the mid-80s. So the point is, over the years, maybe that's been disregarded a little bit, but over the years, these things have been viewed by most legislators as quite good, the idea of getting the two parties together and sitting down and talking about things. And that's what we were trying to do here. Now, we may have failed in our effort at this point, but that's part of this process, to find out what the problems are and change them. And at this point, in any case, that was the attempt. Now, there was discussions about, for instance, some of the criticisms were that, for instance, one of the comments was made that the director of mediation ends up as a judge. I would totally disagree with that. This is not arbitration. This is mediation. And if you go to page 7 of the bill, what you'll find is several remedies and outcomes that can take place. And what it talks about is, for instance, under subdivision 7 or subdivision 6, If an agreement is reached between the two parties, then you get a mediation release. That's the effect of it as you go through here. If an agreement is not reached, in other words, a judge doesn't say you have to reach an agreement. If it is not reached between the party, then something else, it continues to occur. Now, there may be things here that are slanted. I don't think that really was our intent, but if that's the case, I'd be glad to straighten them out so that it's not, because it's supposed to be true mediation, not arbitration, and it's not supposed to be that the director of extension is a judge, but instead that in the second issue of this bill is this simple. We believed that it might be wise to have people sit down and try to have two parties come together, hopefully they're neighbors, and work things out before they hired lawyers. Now, I understand why some lawyers wouldn't like that. But the fact is, that's what our hope was in dealing with this. I know that there's a Chapter 114 and there's a way for mediation, but that's in the process. It's once the lawyers have already started in the process. This was an attempt, at least, to do it up front. The other thing is, it was brought up that it was simply to be a delay tactic. No, I don't think so. The intent was to try and find a way to abate the problem without getting into a court and costing both sides a lot of money, and it costs a lot of money. The other things are that the right to farm to be unconstitutional, I already mentioned that one of the parts that might be unconstitutional about the existing law is the fact that it doesn't treat people equally. The last thing I want to mention is this idea of family farms. I've been hearing this for 30 years. This kind of farmer is the right kind of farmer. That kind of farmer is the bad kind of farmer. And I've heard it from both sides. The big farmers don't like the little farmers because they're giving them trouble, and the little farmers don't like the big farmers because they think they're running them out of business. Let me tell you something. You make on hogs, very few of you probably raise any hogs around the table here, but here's what you make on a hog. Per hog, somewhere between $8 and $10. Now, I want you to think about something. Think about your own salary and your own family income. And then I want you to divide $8 or $10 into that amount. And that's how many hogs you would have to raise in order to make a family living. And that's why hog farms are large these days. That's why cattle farms are large, and that's why crop farmers are large. I farmed until 1987, and I farmed 600 acres and 2,500 hogs, and I was one of the larger operations in my county. Today, I would be considered nothing. And the guy that farms my land today, and I rent it out, I still own the farm, farms 6,000 acres. And nobody in our community thinks there's anything particularly wrong with that, or that it's a terribly bad thing. But when it comes to hog farms, they have other kinds of issues, and I'm aware of that with people. And so all we're asking you is to make a simple decision about those two issues. One, should there be an alternative mediation? Two, going to court and then getting mediation, because it was indicated that 80% would come after that. And that's a judge's decision. He doesn't have to make them do that. Okay? And maybe if this mediation were there, maybe he wouldn't do it so often. From the judicial side, I don't know. Maybe that's something that the Civil Law Committee could ferret out. And secondly, should there be equality when it comes to these sizes and so forth, so that in the future there's an opportunity for the next generation to be coming from a small farm, if in fact they can make it work that way, or a larger farm if they feel they have to make it work that way. And that's really all this is about. Now, I know there's particulars about the bill, and I thought many of those would probably be dealt with between here and civil law. And I also believe that in civil law, I'm sure there are a lot of attorneys on the Civil Law Committee that could tear it apart. But the idea, the concept, was those two simple things from my standpoint. Now, people don't have to believe that. But from my standpoint, at least, that's what I believe we were trying to do. And we copied bits and pieces from Iowa law and your farmer lender mediation provision. And that's where it came from, for the most part. And along the way, staff, as you work to write bills, staff has an influence. and staff had some input into it and so forth, and that's how this bill came about. But it's not some evil empire kind of a deal trying to take over the world. And so with that, I'll stop, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. This is probably maybe the last time I ever testify at this committee. So I appreciate working with all of you over the years as an aside to that. Okay. And that's what it is, and you take a vote, and it's either it's up or down.
Thank you. We have Representative Bly had some questions. You still have those?
Actually, I was asked by someone who couldn't be here to read some testimony, and it's a long letter, so I'll only read half of it, if with permission.
Go ahead.
All right. This is from Christy Rosenquist from Zumbrota Township in Goodhue County. The vast majority of feedlots in Minnesota are already protected from nuisance laws lawsuits under the existing law. This bill removes the 1,000 animal units of hogs and 2,500 cattle cap. Why? There may be no definition of family farm, but my definition is a farm where the family lives on the same property as their animals and where their house is the closest house to the feedlot. We learned during the Senate hearing on this bill last week that there is precisely one nuisance lawsuit against a feedlot in Minnesota at this time. One. The lawsuit was brought by seven families whose peaceful enjoyment of their rural homes was ruined when an out-of-state, out-of-town facility moved in. At least two or three families sold their homes and moved to save their health. Others would like to leave but can't afford to. The lawsuit is against a very large sow facility in Todd County owned by the Gourley brothers, who live in Iowa. The managers appear to be a family-owned corporation based in Mapleton, Minnesota, about 150 miles from the facility. I think it is safe to say this is not a family farm. The estimate to equip this facility with biofilters at the time it was built was about $1.5 million. This would likely have prevented the destruction of the lives of these seven surrounding families. Those being sued claim biofilters are not cost-effective for them, but apparently hiring lobbyists and lawyers to get a law passed for the benefit of one facility is cost-effective, because here we are. The bill authors falsely label this bill as farm neighbor mediation. Can anyone explain how either the owners or the managers of the only facility being sued for nuisance are neighbors or even farmers, other than an absentee property ownership? Do you plan for these seven Todd County families to go to mediation with the hogs? The owners and managers don't live anywhere near Todd County. I and my neighbors in Goodhue County have been opposing installation of a 4,700 hog facility with a 3.5 million gallon manure pit and an open composter for about 140 dead hogs per year. This is proposed on land adjoining mine. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's environmental assessment worksheet concluded that they don't know how many private wells are within 1 mile of the proposed facility, nor did they figure out where those wells are located. However, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency assures us that our drinking water from those wells is in no danger. The air quality prediction model in the same EAW concluded that my neighbor's 70 beef cows produce more hydrogen sulfide, more ammonia, and more odor than will 4,700 hogs over 3.5 million gallons of manure and 140 composted dead hogs. The owners won't live at the facility. No one will. Just the 18 families within 1 mile. This is not a family farm. The family proposing this facility has already stated clearly, we are here to make money, not friends. I don't really see how mediation could be successful under these conditions. If you pass the bill, I and my neighbors lose our last resort to protect our homes if we need to file a nuisance lawsuit. This is already a daunting task due to the costs. This bill would make it virtually impossible. I don't think these massive producers whose production activities are dictated by Hormel and Tyson Foods need protection. I think those of us already living in rural Minnesota need protection. Do not rip the legal rights of recourse from your rural constituents. Don't pretend that these large non-family farms will behave as neighbors in mediation. Thank you, Christy Rosenquist. Thank you for letting me do that.
You're welcome, Representative Bly. Is there other questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. And this has been tossed around in my mind ever since this morning. And I want to make sure I understand that a feedlot facility is what I would probably call a barn, a hog barn, right? Is that actually the definition of a feedlot facility would be the barn itself, or it would be the multiple barns in one location.
Chair Anderson?
You're asking a
question? No, I want to know.
Mr. Chairman, I could answer that, I think, and maybe Mr. Preisler could help me along if I stumble on something because he knows it better than I. But, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, a feedlot is that owner's operation there. So it would very oftentimes be more than one barn, not just a single barn, but oftentimes more than one barn. One of the reasons, quite frankly, that people use different operations in different places rather than having, for instance, farrowing and young pigs growing up and finishing all in one spot is to help control disease. It's similar to what I always compare it to when you take a bunch of kids. I have a granddaughter that's in kindergarten, and she comes home every week with a new sniffle and every week with a new piece, either flu or cold or something, because you take 30 little kids and you throw them all in one room from different places, and they all get sick. So part of the method that is used in a lot of these operations is to put, for instance, a sow operation in one spot and a grower area in another one, finishing area, and so forth. And so there, depending upon how it's done, and there are rules within the MPCA relative to phased and connected and a lot of things, there's different ways that they get linked up in terms of what is a feedlot. Each feedlot probably is built the same way because of the rules in the sense of how the manure is stored and how it's put out and all those kinds of things. But it may be different in terms of its organizational effort with the individual buildings.
I really want a pretty straightforward answer because this is according to the law. There's a lot of lawyers in here. Maybe Mr. Preisler knows. By the way, Mr. Preisler can teach you a lot about hogs. The feedlot facility, I think it's an issue, to be honest with you, because when you're talking about the barns that are scattered about, it's been my observation, not professional at all, but it's been my observation, when the smaller barns are scattered about, there seems to be less problem. And that is a pretty important part of this law. So, Mr. Preisler, I'm going to ask you to come forward if you can. And because when I read it as a feedlot facility being one, what I would call one barn. He needs a chair.
Yes.
What's the way?
Sure. For the record, Dave Preisler with the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. So a feedlot is what would be at one, like, legal description of property. Okay, think of it that way. It could be one single barn. You could have two barns. You could have three barns. They're going to be right, if you have two or three barns on that site, they're going to be right next to each other. Okay? So if there is a feedlot that is maybe owned by the same person that is on the south piece of a section of ground and another one that may be on the north of that whole section of ground a mile away, those are probably two different sites. Okay? So when we look at what a feedlot is, it's going to be on its own description of property, and it will be multiples or just a single barn. And so when you drive out in the countryside, if you drive along Highway 14 in your district, you will see a number of feedlot sites. Many of them will look very similar. They'll either have one barn, two barns, three barns, four barns. Okay, that's going to be very, very typical of what you would see. But each feedlot is going to be a combination of that, but they're all going to be right next to each other. Okay. Often connected by hallways, served. The MPCA also has got a definition to where if they're all served by the same well, if they're served by the same electric service that would come to that site, I mean, those things also go into what that site would actually be. Does that clear up the question?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Clark?
It helps a little. I'm still trying to get, I guess, when I don't understand something while I try and say it back. The question is, maybe I'm not appropriate in being stuck on the concept of feedlot facility. I thought that might have a distinct meaning, but My point is then, so I'm assuming, when I, and again, I see that, usually I see at most two barns. There's not, in where I live, they're kind of scattered. And I also want to make it clear that where I live, these issues do not emerge much that we've heard from these, from the comments. And I associate those two. And so I see the value in this, in the smaller facilities. What I see, I think they raise less challenges for the neighbors. I that's just what I've observed. My second question that relates to that is I'm curious, how many feedlot facilities have a swine capacity of 1,000 or more animals, and how many don't? What's the breakdown? Is it half and half? Is it 10%? What percentage of feedlot facilities in Minnesota would have a capacity of more than 1,000 animals?
Sure. So if we look at
go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. If we look at just on the pig side, I think the number that we heard from the Pollution Control Agency earlier today was like 600 and it was like 693, something in that range, of hog facilities that would be over 1,000 animal units.
1,600 livestock facilities that were over 1,000.
Yep. So if we look at total, first of all species, roughly 1,600 sites would be over 1,000 animal units in the state, okay? Now, if we look at between just pigs, between 1,000 and 2,000 animal units, okay, we'd have about just under 700 of those, okay? We do have a few, not very many. I don't need much more than two hands to count them that would be over 2,000 animal units for pigs, okay? So it's, as we look at it, we've got about 3,000 hog farms in the state, okay? So to say that we've got, you know, 700 or a little stronger than that are over 1,000 animal units, that's a substantial part of the business in Minnesota. You know, and those are all owned by, you know, for the vast majority of them, 95% plus, by local people. You know, Minnesota residents. We don't see people, it's pretty rare, quite honestly, that people move in from other states to set up shop here, because this is not an easy place to do that with. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of these issues, and Mr. Schoenfeld did a nice job of discussing this earlier, a lot of these issues, if you take a look at it, really go back to the local level. You know, and I'll give the Nicollet County Commissioners, so in your district, credit for a whole lot of foresight back 30, 35 years ago, where they made it really difficult for a non-farmer to build a home in rural Nicollet County. They said, if you're going to live in our county and you're not a farmer, we want you to live in St. Peter, or we want you to live in North Mankato or in Nicollet. And they made it pretty tough. And so what happened is that by doing that, you tended to avoid a whole lot of conflict because you weren't mixing land uses. And so, you know, they had some foresight or else luck way back when. But a lot of these things that you're hearing about, you know, they're local zoning issues. I mean, you had, you know, zoning commission or county commissioners that have made these siting decisions, you know, from a standpoint of how far facilities can be away from neighbors. And the vast majority of these are not controversial. They're not. There are some that are, and we don't deny that, but the majority are not. And so I think you referenced your experience in Nicollet County. Vast majority of those are not controversial. I mean, they get along with each other. They're in an ag-zoned area. They've been there for generations. They're trying to bring the next generation back. You know, and for the vast majority of them, treat each other with respect, which we would expect would happen and should.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just like to, I'm in a bind because my colleagues have left. My guess is that I share a committee with them, and I want to vote in that committee. So I will be leaving. But I want to just make my comments, and that is, you can see where I'm questioning that. I take to heart, it seems like about a quarter of the farms are within this realm. I think that's relevant. I also do want to just make the overall comment. There's obviously a problem with the mediation in this bill. I think that's recognized, but the concept is rich. I really think the concept is rich, and I don't know if we can solve it this this session, but the idea of people talking over this prior to getting to the legal system makes good sense. And I think when you reference Neckla County, again, where I represent, I think that's been the history of to work it through, and there's procedures even after ongoing to give citizens the opportunity to get some feedback. And I think it needs some work. But, again, my apologies to the committee, but I there's another vote I have to go make right now. Thank you.
Okay, folks, at this time, members and people in the audience, as you can tell, we have members that are moving to other committees for votes, and I apologize for that. That's what happens when we get into this time in session. But right now, we're going to call a recess for 10 minutes or to call out of the chair.
Keep this the way it is, and you only have armor neighbor mediation kind of process. Does that, how would that, could that, is that a better, I don't know, I'm just, I'm trying to.
Maybe what it boils down to is if we take this out, is it going to encourage more neighborhood?
And I, you know, I appreciate that our, these are many that are farms, that are farmer owned. And to live, you know, that there is a long list on the farm. That's one of the stories that are coming out is that as people buying some land, and maybe it is maybe the stream that they're living there.
heard, and it's the people that are providing this testimony, either in written form or in who've come before us. I think the testimony this morning, the woman who talked about the pebbles in her hand and don't take away my pebbles. I mean, I think that that's a pretty compelling testimony to say, you know, this is all we've got, you know, and what we've got is an important aspect for us. And so I think that we can't disregard that. We can't just assume that, you know, there's one right answer and everybody else is the wrong answer. So I understand and appreciate the pork producers, and I understand that they want fairness, but I also understand the people who are impacted by this want fairness, that there's some legal rights, there's property rights, there's all these things that are going on. It just seems as though we still have a number of issues with this. And I think the other issue that I have is that we talk, obviously, in this committee, this is an ag committee. We talk about agriculture. We're pro-agriculture. We live it. We breathe it. We either, you know, currently are farmers for some. Maybe we grew up on a farm. Whatever our story is, we really appreciate agriculture. And I want us to continue to appreciate agriculture. But I get concerned when we have a bill, you know, and we've had a couple of these nuisance bills that were giving agriculture a bad name and a black eye. And I just get worried that we, we're trying to fix something that maybe doesn't rise to the level of a needing fixing. And if we're, you know, I don't know if we're at that point or not, but I guess I have appreciated that we've been able to spend some time on this bill this morning and this evening to be able to hear the testimony, hear, you know, I appreciate Mr. Carlson, Mr. Carpenter coming forward and giving us, kind of the legal, background and for us to be able to understand it better. But I just have to tell you, I have angst, I have concern, I have I just think that we maybe need to spend maybe more time talking about it and try to figure out a better way to deal with this or not deal with it. But I don't have a question other than I think we want to support agriculture, and we do support agriculture. But I also respect the people who have come before us today and provided some testimony, and I just needed to say that, so thank you.
Okay, any other questions from members? Representative Block.
No, just a comment. Mr. Schoenauer, you made the comment about, and I know you didn't mean it in this way necessarily, but comment about thinking that these big farms are evil in some way. And I'm sure that the dialogue about this has evolved that way at times. But I think that you could look at it as an experiment, moving in the direction of these larger farms that we didn't know necessarily the consequences of. We didn't know how it would affect folks. And I think there's been good and bad in the experiment. And I think one of the things that we learned today, and it's difficult to ignore, I think as Representative Poppy was alluding to, there are some people who have been hurt by it and might, you know, fairly see it as something that's destructive to their livelihood. And I think it's important to recognize it's something that we need to keep asking ourselves, is this working out? We don't know where agriculture is headed in the next 20 years, perhaps. We don't know what it will look like. We know that it has changed over time from having big operators and small operators, but it has changed the landscape and will probably continue to change the landscape. And I guess I'm concerned that we really try hard to listen to each other. That would be my comment, I guess.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Representative Bly.
Mr. Chairman, just one point.
Make it quick.
Yeah, absolutely. Joel Carlson, Association for Justice. This one's way down low. we do toil away in the Civil Law Committee.
on these issues, and we appreciate that. But Abraham Lincoln said, the law is much too important to leave to the lawyers. And so we need to know what's in this bill. The point that's being missed here when they talk about being in compliance and the changes that were made, you need to know that at the time this right-to-farm law was being passed, Minnesota recognized an odor standard. We had a test for it. It was recognized by the Pollution Control Agency. And that rule was repealed after the adoption of the law you're talking about now. They repealed that in 2000. So when you talk about being in compliance with all of the rules and regulations, there is no regulation for odor. And what the PCA said when they eliminated the odor standard is that we're going to leave these issues to local decision-making, whether it's zoning or nuisance actions, to control these problems. So a very big part of what we had when Right to Farm first passed, particularly as it relates to the size of the facility, was eliminated by the Pollution Control Agency in 2000. So what we used to have for protection, and you could hold someone accountable, we no longer have that. And nuisance is their only thing that they have left. And I think that gets lost on us as we're talking about the passage of time. So just wanted to make sure you knew that what used to protect the public when this law passed in the 90s is no longer there.
Very good. Okay. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really am going to only just share a perspective, and I think that one of the things that I'm struggling with is that we're talking about a spectrum of circumstances and a spectrum of experiences that people have. I'm quite aware of situations where somebody came in and maliciously, came in and caused themselves to get control in a county and then caused themselves, by pre-figuring this out, to then have the opportunity to enter into and build a large number of whatever they would like to, because they had the power and control as enumerated by the laws. On the other hand, I happen to know personally an operation that is a family operation. The owner, the top guy in the operation, is just a few years older than me, grew up probably 6 miles from my family of origin. They run thousands of hogs in Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois, and his two sons. So it is a family operation. I am certain they are incorporated somehow, you know, for the structure of this. They have taken their whole operation organic. So the spectrum of my own experience is having seen malicious intent against somebody else who turns their operation to the farthest extent of responsibility and care in terms of operations. What's put before us is to try to manage the aberrations. And I think that that's why we're having trouble. He has come and testified that there are pork producers that are good people trying to run very good operations. And I think that that's what becomes troublesome, because I have personal knowledge of people that did everything they could do to thwart whatever laws existed and have successfully put up their operations, and it's not the one most wonderful neighbor in the area. So how we deal with that spectrum is really the challenge that I have in front of me that I cannot reconcile. So I'm hoping that through either the dialogue and or however this gets constructed, that we can end with that a person does have an avenue of final recourse if intentional abuse becomes apparent and they have to exercise that all the way out. That's the context in which I find this so troubling to try to have to deal with.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bly.
So I'd ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call. Representative Anderson, do you have any closing comments?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A lot has been said tonight and this morning on this bill. And I think we would agree that as it moves on, if it moves on, it needs some additional work, especially on the mediation side. And I think the Civil Law Committee is the appropriate place to do that, or get it ready before that committee. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1221 be re-referred to the Committee of Civil Law and Data Practice.
Okay, Mr. Webster, if you could take roll call.
Anderson?
Yes.
Thacker?
Yes.
Bennett?
Yes.
Bly?
No.
Daniels? Johnson?
No.
Kanesh Boudin?
No.
Luke?
Yes.
Mahoney?
No.
Mariani? Miller?
Yes.
Nornes?
Yes.
Pearson?
Excuse me?
Yes or no? We're a roll call.
I hear you.
Pearson?
Yes.
Poppy?
No.
Poston?
Yes.
Salk?
Okay. Vote being 8 yes, 6 no, the motion prevails. And members, we are adjourned. Thank you.